Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, October 9th, 2025. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Evan Simcoe Bednarski, documentary photographer, and journalist covering transit for the New York Daily News, on the Daily News Union and their fight for a fair contract. Then, Josh Orton, president of Demand Justice, former advisor to Senator Bernie Sanders. I should say both those guests, former producers on the Majority Report. Also on the program today, Israel and Hamas agree to the first phase of a ceasefire. We'll see. Meanwhile, National Guard poised to enter Chicago as Trump reportedly considering the Insurrection Act and jailing Democratic leaders. Republican fissures grow as they feel the heat of the government shutdown. Presidential Records Act and DOJ independence down the tubes as a new report shows Trump directing the DOJ to prosecute his enemies. Meanwhile, Trump scheduled for Friday to have his second routine annual checkup in 6 months. New reports, David Frum, Douglas Murray moonlighting as speechwriters for Israeli officials. Meanwhile, New York Times, CNN employ journalists getting paid by a fellowship that, quote, helps Israel win the info war. Over 25% of the FBI now has been reassigned to prowl cities looking for immigrants. Pentagon has 300 open investigations into criticism of Charlie Kirk amongst military personnel. Labor Department says immigration raids are causing significant, quote, risk of supply shock induced food shortages. All this and more on today's Majority Report. I almost said a Majority Report, but she is out today, having done a Majority Report Wednesday this week. Emma will be back on Monday. Nevertheless, I mean, I'm here, so we'll see. We're already getting complaints. That's why I say that. I'm already noticing, like, people are complaining. And I'm just saying, like, it's one day. People can deal with it.
Can Emma have a day off?
Yeah, exactly. Emma is having...
What kind of bull is this?
I think we're going to be, like, on day two of, at least, you know, for me, in a row of not criticizing Chuck Schumer. Hopefully. We'll see. I'm not sure, actually. I mean, when we talk to Josh Orton from Demand Progress, I'm not sure we'll be able to sustain that. But we had at least one day, and the Democrats seem to be holding tight. Not caving to Republican demands, not providing them votes to open the government. Now, the main point is, I mean, the Democrats are I think quite effectively leveraging the fact that we have literally 20 million Americans who are about 25 days out from either losing their insurance or having to pay $35, $50, $100, 200% increases in their healthcare premiums.
Impossible.
And the Democrats, one of the stipulations to the continuing resolution they want is a fix to the the Affordable Care Act subsidies. Really not a fix, just an extension of these subsidies that have been ongoing for several years. Remember, health insurance rates are going to go up simply because of the people who are being kicked off of Medicaid, because we're going to see people come into emergency rooms and seeking care. Hospitals are going to have to pay for that. All of their rates are going to go up, et cetera, et cetera. And insurance companies are already planning a gradual rise and increase in the prices of their premiums relative to what it would be if they just did it in late 2026 when those Medicaid provisions come in. However, the other issue is, of course, why would you vote for a budget when the president and the head of the Office of Budget Management have already said they're not going to abide by this budget anyways, that they can at any time they want unilaterally cut funds and withhold funds that have been appropriated? So why would you participate in that process? That is part of the demands of the Democrats. It's not the one that they're pushing because they apparently don't think the American public can understand that. Maybe, maybe. I'm not going to argue with the success that has existed to this point. But understand, the Republicans could pass this budget if they wanted to. They have so-called nuked the filibuster on already three different occasions this year. They have done it for appointees to the Trump administration. They have done it with restricting California's ability to increase their CAFE standards. And there's been at least one other occasion. I can't remember off the top of my head. But the fact is, they have shown that the filibuster is not sacrosanct when they want to get rid of it. They just don't want responsibility to pass this budget without these extensions on the ACA subsidies, because then they know they are really in the hot seat. As far as I'm concerned, let's get rid of the filibuster. Let's get rid of it. Let's let the American public understand the implications of voting for one party or the other. And let's make both parties own their votes. The filibuster has been, in too many situations, a way to help both parties simultaneously avoid taking votes that they think are politically untenable or politically dangerous or risky. Meanwhile, Donald Trump has floated the idea of not paying furloughed workers. That is against the law. But again, he's been ignoring other laws. So whether he can do it and get away with it is two different things. What the government could do right now is they could fund a bill to pay people who are working and not getting checks. They could do this for federal workers, too, who are furloughed. They're supposed to get back pay. If you're working now in the military or in the Gestapo, otherwise known as ICE, I think I-C-E, is like some German acronym for Gestapo.
Yes, sir.
Apparently. But they could be paid now with just a piece of legislation. Remember, Congress has been told to go off on vacation, but they can be called back. Congress and the Senate still can pass laws. They could still swear in Congress people, but Mike Johnson doesn't want to do that. And here he is taking a call on C-SPAN and lying to a constituent.
Hi, Mr. Johnson. So my question or comments are related to what you said yesterday about not being open to pass any legislation to ensure that military gets paid. I'm sure you can tell by my voice I'm very shaky. Just want you to hear a little bit about my family. I have two medically fragile children. I have a husband who actively serves this country. He suffers from PTSD from his two tours in Afghanistan. If we see a lapse in pay come the 15th, my children do not get to get the medication that's needed for them to live their life. Because we live paycheck to paycheck. I heard you earlier say that you side with President Trump on anything that he says. Well, I just read an article this morning that said he absolutely wholeheartedly believes that there needs to be legislation put in so that we do not miss a paycheck. You have the power to do that. And as a Republican, I'm very disappointed in my party, and I'm very disappointed in you because you do have the power to call the House back. You did that, or you refused to do that just for a show. I am begging you to pass this legislation. My kids could die. We don't have the credit because of the medical bills that I have to pay regularly. You could stop this, and you could be the one that could say military is getting paid. And I think that it is awful, and the audacity of someone who makes six figures a year to do this to military families is insane.
All right, Samantha.
Samantha, I'm so sorry to hear about your situation. The reason I've been so angry this week, and they've been calling me out on media, Johnson's angry. I am angry because of situations just like yours. I have a big military district, and my district is the home of the Global Strike Command at Barksdale Air Force Base and Fort Polk, the Joint Readiness Training Center. I have
that's irrelevant.
Military districts and military families in America. I have a lot of airmen and soldiers who are deployed right now, and they have young families at home, and they have children in health situations like yours. This is what keeps me up at night.
No,
I want you to hear something very clearly. The Republicans are the ones delivering for you. We had a vote to pay the troops. It was the continuing resolution 3 weeks ago. Every single Republican but two voted to keep the government open so that your paycheck can flow. Every Democrat in the House, except for one, voted to close it. The Democrats are the ones that are preventing you from getting a check. If we did another a vote on the floor, pay troops, it's not a lawmaking exercise because Chuck Schumer is going to hold that up in the Senate. He is demonstrating by voting now six times to keep the government closed that he does not want the troops to be paid. And you should listen to his comments last night, as reported this morning. He is enjoying this. He said every day gets better for us, quote unquote. Chuck Schumer and the Democrats are preventing your family from getting the care they need, not Republicans. And my heart goes out to you.
And now, I don't know what it is in Mike Johnson's private life that has made him so good at lying. Like, I mean, to get that good at lying, you almost have to live a lie in your private life. But that's not important. What's important is let's just go. I think this is a clip from literally hours earlier. It was this press conference yesterday. No, this is 2 days ago. So this was 1 day earlier. Here is Mike Johnson being asked that same question. Are you open to passing legislation? Because at the beginning of the call, the woman said you weren't open to passing legislation. He may have said that on Wednesday, but on Tuesday, this is what he said. And guess what? It was not Chuck Schumer who came in and said, we won't pass that in the Senate. Watch this clip.
I know you said the House has done its job. However, military members are going to be missing a paycheck on October 15th. Critical air traffic controllers are already missing from the job in some areas.
Yeah.
Would you be open to pay for members of the military and air traffic controllers as an emergency measure in the next week or so or 2 weeks?
Yeah, we're monitoring it day by day. I'm certainly open to that. We've done it in the past. We want to make sure that our troops are paid. I have colleagues like Congresswoman Jen Kiggins of Virginia, who has a big military district. She's already filed legislation to pay our troops. We're looking forward to processing all this as soon as we gather everybody back up. But again, the most immediate thing is turn the lights back on here and keep Congress working so we can take care of all this important business.
Yeah, and honestly, I mean, you don't need that. You don't need to. Obviously, there are certain constituencies, many of whom are going to be impacted in a very negative way by what's happening here. But the simplest way to end it.
Okay, all right, let's stop it right there. Watch Mike Johnson's head. He's just said we're open to doing that. And then John Thune, who is the majority leader in the Senate, he doesn't want to bring that bill up. And Mike Johnson, like the little puppy he is, he nods. Yes, sir. Like Thune comes in and says, little guy, get out of the way.
Excuse me. Let's get the 6 foot guy in here.
Yeah, exactly. Listen, 4 foot three. Step over the side. I'm going to come in here and tell you why this is wrong. Look at this.
Open to that. We've done it in the past. We want to make sure that our troops are paid. I have colleagues like Congresswoman Jen Kiggins of Virginia, who has a big military district. She's already filed legislation.
Oh, there's already legislation. Is that right?
We're processing all this as soon as we get everybody
back up. Oh, so we could do this if you just called everybody back in.
Turn the lights back on here and keep Congress working so we can take care of all
this. Well, you could call them back in and they could keep looking. Watch his head. Watch his head.
You don't need that. You don't need to.
Right.
Obviously,
I screwed up.
Sorry. Oh, yeah, sorry.
Yeah. So I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
We could, but we don't need it.
I'm sorry, Daddy. I'm sorry.
It's like a ventriloquist arguing with his dummy.
Exactly. But I mean, look at how Mike Johnson was able to take that call from a military wife, mother of two children, who she's afraid they're going to die.
The most desperate circumstances.
And he then just does a 180 from what he had said 36 hours before. Completely lies about it. Completely lies about it. And here's the thing. If you think the Democrats could hold out, if you think Chuck Schumer is going to stand in the way of military personnel getting paid, you're nuts. Put aside whether they should be getting paid now or not. Frankly, all federal workers should be getting paid while they're furloughed. They're supposed to get back pay. We should be paying them right now. But if you think Chuck Schumer's going to stand in the way of that, no. John Thune and his little yes man, Mike Johnson, they don't want to take the pressure off. They want to force the Democrats to vote for a continuing resolution, even though it means nothing. Donald Trump can stop paying whatever he wants because they're not holding him to it. Johnson is just, this guy has a violent allergy to the truth. He's just sitting there, like, grinding out lie after lie.
It's crazy to have a Christian podcast about, like, how to have your principles reflect in politics and just be the most flagrant liar.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. Like, the truth goes through a meat grinder with this guy, honestly. All right. In a moment, we're going to be talking to Evan Simcoe Bednarski. He's a documentary photographer and journalist covering transit for the New York Daily News. And then we'll be talking to Josh Orton, president of Demand Justice. First, a couple words from our sponsors. This is a product, actually, that I've used for, 10 years. And thank you for it. Delete Me makes it easy, quick, and safe to remove your personal data online at a time when surveillance and data breaches are common enough to make everyone vulnerable. I'll tell you, not only have I been using this for 10 years, just because of the nature of this business, but it also helps dramatically with like phishing scams, and they're just getting significantly more sophisticated. when your personal data is scrubbed from these these media, what are they called? Info brokers, folks who steal information or buy information on the dark web can't match it up. It's very, very helpful. I recently met a reporter who writes about a lot of the stuff going on in the right wing. And the first thing, like, we asked each other was, do you have Delete Me? And we both were like, yes. Delete Me does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information from data broker websites. Delete Me knows your privacy is worth protecting. Sign up, provide Delete Me with exactly what information you want deleted, and their experts take it from there. Delete Me sends you regularly personalized privacy reports showing what info they found, where they found it, and what they removed. It is not, Delete Me is not a one-time service, because these broker sites, they repopulate. So it's constantly going out there and doing takedown notices. It's very effective. Thanks to Delete Me for sponsoring the Majority Report and for its service in general, frankly. Take control of your data. Keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me now at a special discount for our listeners. Get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to www.joindeleteme.com/majority. Use the promo code MAJORITY at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/majority. Enter the code MAJORITY at checkout. That's www.joindeleteme.com/majority. The code is MAJORITY. We'll put that in our podcast and YouTube descriptions. Also, sponsoring the program today, I haven't been sleeping well. In the middle of the night, I get up and I want a snack. And I don't know what it is about cereal, but it's obviously it's easy. But there's also something that I find like it's like a comfort food for me. But I don't want to go up and get a bunch of sugar inside of me, because then it's hard for me to go back to sleep. So hello, Magic Spoon. Magic Spoon's been a go-to for me for also, I don't know, 5 or 6 years. Since they came out.
Long time.
It's been a long time. Every serving of Magic Spoon high-protein cereal has 13 grams of protein, 0 grams of sugar, 4 grams of net carbs. They come in nostalgic, homey, like you were a kid, flavors of fruity, cocoa, and frosted. They also have seasonal flavors. And now they also have these high-protein treats, which are like, I don't know, they're like bars, but they're like crunchy, airy, easy way to get 12 grams of protein on the go. They come in flavors like marshmallow and chocolate peanut butter and dark chocolate, and now I'm hungry. Both are great on the go or pre or post workout or as a midnight snack. There you go. I like to have my eating habits reinforced. Get $5 off your next order at magicspoon.com/majorityreport, or look for Magic Spoon on Amazon or in your nearest grocery store. That's magicspoon.com/majorityreport for $5 off. Check it out. You will enjoy these, I promise you. Quick break. And we'll have Evan Simcoe Bednarski on from the New York Daily News Union to talk about their fight for a fair contract. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. Emma Vigeland out today. Joining us now, Evan Simcoe Bednarski. He is a journalist covering transit for the New York Daily News, and he is also the vice unit chair of the Daily News Union and also a Majority Report emeritus producer. Evan, welcome back to the show.
Happy to be here. Happy to be here.
All right. So I saw recently a testimony that you gave in front of the New York City Council. Mm-hmm. Give us a sense of of what the situation has been with the Daily News. And for people who are outside of New York, maybe give us a little bit of a history of the Daily News, because it really is the most local of New York papers, it seems to me. And yours is a story of the demise of local news in many respects, or the threat to the local news. And if it can happen in New York, it's going to happen anywhere.
Yeah, the Daily News represents what a lot of papers used to represent in this city. You know, it's a hard scrabble tabloid from when that wasn't a bad word. And, you know, we covered the city for about 106 years. I think we're coming up on 107. And it was one of the first papers to really run photographs in a big way. Anything that's happened in this city, the Daily News has covered it. The Daily News was responsible for, you know, breaking the case wide open on the fact that the air wasn't safe after 9/11. You know, the Daily News famously reported on President Ford not bailing the city out during the fiscal crisis of the 70s. You know, it is, to the extent that New York has a sort of, you know, working class shoe leather local daily newspaper anymore, it's the Daily News. And about 4 years ago, the company that owned the Daily News, Tribune, was purchased by Alden Global Capital, which is a private equity firm that has sort of earned the odious moniker of destroyer of newspapers. And we have been, you know, we unionized shortly after and have been trying to negotiate a contract ever since.
So you guys have not had a contract since the new owner took over?
Correct. We've been at the table a little bit more than 3.5 years now.
How much, what does it do to the morale when you get bought by somebody or some entity like that?
It's not great. I mean, the thing about the Daily News is you work at the Daily News because you believe in this place. You know, I grew up, you know, I mentioned in my testimony, I grew up reading the paper at my grandpa's table. Our unit chair, Michael Sheridan, he's a legacy member of the Daily News. His dad was a rewrite guy for many years. It's someplace that you work because you really believe in the institution and the work. And, you know, the morale has taken a hit because it's clear that our owners don't view us that way. You know, we're out there working really hard every day, you know, hours that we don't always get paid for. And, you know, that's not reflected in the investment. You know, you mentioned that, you know, this is a story of the demise of local news nationwide, and it is and it isn't, because, you know, to the best of our knowledge, the Daily News still turns a profit. We just don't get to see any of that. That's not invested back in the paper in any way.
What do you think? I mean, what's the agenda of somebody who buys a newspaper and then sort of starts to starve it? The Daily News, like you say, it makes a profit, which is rare in the newspaper world. If you want to make a profit, you don't necessarily buy a newspaper. That's not what you would go and do for an investment strategy, I guess. Like, what do you think is the agenda of an ownership group that buys a paper, starves the employees? What's going on there?
I mean, we don't really know. And I think this is as good a time as any to say, Alden Global Capital and Heath Freeman, who's, you know, the head of it, it's an extremely opaque entity. We went out to Montauk to try to ring Heath's doorbell, and there isn't even a doorbell at the gate at the end of his very long driveway out there. We had to leave a handwritten note. So these guys don't, you know, they don't always respond to the request for information that we make at the bargaining table. They don't, you know, we don't always even have staff meetings. It's very opaque. But the sense that I get is that this is like anything else that private equity invests in. You know, there's something with nominal value. You buy it, you squeeze as much of that value out, and then you drop it. You know, they sold our printing plant in Jersey City for $90 million. None of that money has come back. One of the things that happens a lot at this newspaper is that when people leave, either for better paying jobs or they retire, those positions don't get backfilled. So there's headcount floating around, you know, ostensibly. And it's not gone to, you know, we don't have an Albany reporter. We don't have, in this year, we don't have a politics editor. We have very good politics reporters, but no editor who is, you know, in charge of managing this, you know, very fraught, very important election year.
What ends up like, does the paper get smaller or thinner, or is there? Oh, can you hear me? Sorry.
You there?
Okay. Has the paper gotten smaller or thinner? Like what ends up filling the space if you don't have a reporter in Albany, let's say?
It's, you know, so I cover the trains, and the trains are funded in large part by Albany. When I started out, we did have an Albany reporter, and I would often, you know, call up the Albany reporter and just talk, just, you know, shoot the shit. Like, what's going on with funding on this thing? You know, where do you think, you know, X, Y, and Z legislatures are on this issue? And it was useful. It was really useful to be able to understand, you know, what was happening that would ultimately trickle down and affect our readers, you know, in terms of what train lines were getting upgraded, you know, what kind of repairs could be expected, that sort of thing. You fly blind when you don't have that. And that's just, you know, my little tiny local beat.
But also on top of, I mean, obviously, like, it makes the report, I mean, to not have somebody in Albany, it just seems crazy to me. But how do you fill the pages? Like, I mean, is it you? Are you responsible now to produce X plus words, or are they getting syndicated stuff, or how do they make up the difference?
We do end up running a lot of wire copy. It does not translate so far into, you know, sort of an increased quota or anything on our end. But there are holes in the coverage, and the paper is, you know, if you're a regular reader of the Daily News and you pick it up, you'll notice that it's a little bit lighter. It's hard to see this paper that has been sort of a giant of covering, you know, power in the city and state, no longer really be able to fill as many pages as it used to. We're very proud of the work that we're doing. We've still managed to you know, do some excellent coverage on the mayoral administration. You know, we've managed to hold a lot of folks you know, to account for various things over the past couple of years. But that's all coming from, you know, the reporters working hard. We don't have a newsroom, which is something that I think people don't fully appreciate who read us regularly. The newsroom was, you know, it was closed like many newsrooms were during the COVID lockdown. But when other papers started to come back, our owners decided it wasn't worth paying the rent on the space anymore. And so, you know, I'm in my apartment right now. You know, we have had on more than one occasion reporters who are collaborating on a story sort of meet after hours, you know, around their kitchen table or something.
I was going to ask, like, do you guys get together like in a informal, come up with your own makeshift newsrooms and a diner or something to that effect? Or
yeah, kind of. I mean, you know, we will get together to plan things out and to compare notes. We're on the phone with each other a lot. You know, I when I can, like to go into there are still press rooms in certain places around the city, like in City Hall and in some of the courthouses, you know, and that's some place where you can sort of set up. And Alden did shell out to rent a 6-desk co-working space in Midtown. But we really kind of go there to, you know, charge our laptop batteries, which, by the way, the laptops that they issued us have very poor batteries. So
I would imagine at this point.
Yeah.
All right. Well,
yeah.
So give us a sense of like, what were you doing in front of the city hall in terms of like testifying, and what are you guys asking? I mean, I get a better sense. Obviously you want a contract, and I know you guys are looking for like fair wages and cost of living increases. I mean, very sort of like vanilla requests here for workers, job protections, benefits, even for part-time workers, some measure of security and some standard benefits. What were you asking from the city council, and what can folks do who read the paper do?
So the city council, a couple of folks in the labor committee reached out and, you know, wanted to author a non-binding resolution in support of our contract fight. And we're, you know, when people that you cover not always favorably want to back you in a fight, that's a good sign. So, you know, that we were speaking in support of that resolution as last week. And I mean, really what we're asking for, like I said, it's not super radical. We have 55 full-time employees and 7 part-time employees covering the city of, you know, 8 and change million people. And we want a living wage. We want to be able to, you know, live in the city that we cover. And, you know, about 90, so we've got, like I said, 55 full-time employees. 19 of those folks are making less than $65,000 a year, which is not livable in this city. We even have some folks making less than $55,000. We want some of the money that we make to come back and be reinvested in this newspaper. And, you know, for that to come to us in the form of like a real, you know, tangible wage increase. Some of the folks who took wage decreases at the beginning of COVID in lieu of a furlough have not been made whole. None of them who took that have been made whole. So you've got folks who've worked here for, you know, a decade or so and are making less now than they did when they started. So we, in a very real way, need to be able to afford to live in the city if we're going to cover it well and we're going to do our jobs for our readers. But the other things we're asking for are things that I think most folks assume people like Daily News reporters already have. We want paid parental leave. We want to be paid on days when we have to go to jury duty, which they don't want to pay us in the upcoming.
I thought that was illegal. I thought you had to pay people.
I mean, you know, there are legal guidelines for things like
that. Matt told me, and he was on like a grand jury for like 6 months.
Special extended one.
There are legal requirements for like parental leave and things of that nature, and you know, and that's what they're saying as well. We'll give you the, you know, but I. Listen, I raised one of my 2 kids on that when I was working at a different outlet, and it's not great. You know, it's not great. They're, you know, trying to eat away at our vacation days. It really is just sort of nickel and diming stuff. You know, in the grand scheme of things, we want to just be able to keep paying our rent and keep doing our jobs.
So what can folks who want to support the Daily News workers do, whether they read the paper on a regular basis or not? What can folks do to help?
Well, one thing we know is that the private equity firm that owns us, Alden Global Capital, and their head honcho, Heath Freeman, they don't like when their names get dragged out. They like to do their buying and selling in secret. And so just talking about it, just like raising the issue, just, you know, supporting.
Is that ALDEN?
Yes,
as
sir.
In Alden Global?
Yeah.
Okay. Just curious.
And they are, you know, if people can sort of join their voice to the city council resolution, we have a petition that you can find at nydnunion.com and sign off on that. That helps us sort of, you know, leverage the support of New Yorkers. But I think part of what's going on here is, you know, private equity firms buy something because they think it's valuable, and they sell something once they think it's not valuable. So any demonstration of the value of this paper to this city is good for us. It helps us. It helps us be able to continue to do our jobs. You know, we don't want to inflict any pain on our owners. We want our owners to invest in us, and we want to be able to do our job. So, you know, anything as simple as subscribing to the paper, buying the paper, talking about the coverage we have, you know, making it clear that we're still a power in this city, is important and helps.
This is where getting on social media can actually have an actual impact. Evan Simcoe Bednarski, we will put a link to the New York Daily Union, nydunion.com, and the petition as well. Thanks so much. Great to see you again. Have you on the show. It's been
a lot of years.
16 years, 14, 15 years.
That's right. Yeah.
All right. Really appreciate it. Evan, thanks so much. Good luck. And hope to see you again soon. All right. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll have another former producer of the Majority Report on. Josh Orton, who is now the president of Demand Justice after working for Bernie Sanders and the Labor Department and Russ Feingold. All come home. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Emma Vigeland out today. Joining us now, Josh Orton, former advisor to Senator Bernie Sanders, former advisor at the White House, former advisor to Senator Russ Feingold and Harry Reid, and now president of Demand Justice. And of course, former producer of the Majority Report, going back to the Air America days.
Former executive producer of
former
the Majority
executive
Report.
Producer.
And, you know, we'll start this off on a bad note of getting bumped behind a more junior former producer. So I just
That's called the lead in. That's the opener.
See. Yes. Okay. Good. All right.
Josh, great to see you and congratulations.
Hey, thank you.
I was so excited about this. We had, Bill, your predecessor on, Brian Fallon on this program years ago at the beginning of the Biden administration, maybe leading up to the Biden administration. And he had worked for Obama and had acknowledged that they really blew it when it came to judges. And this organization was meant to sort of move Democrats and have them appreciate what goes on with the judiciary, which, of course, you know, has been one of my bailiwicks for a long time. Yep. So I was very excited when you took over this organization, or I should say became president?
President.
President. Tell us about Demand Progress, Demand Justice, rather, and what the agenda is before we go into the things that you want to do to execute it.
Yeah. So I guess when I first became aware of Demand Justice, it was when I was actually doing work for NARAL then, which is now Reproductive Freedom for All, fighting the Kavanaugh nomination. And, you know, you and I have the sort of same experience with this. I remember, you know, back in law school reading, you know, 14th Amendment abortion cases, and the democratically nominated Supreme Court justices were talking in the medical terms and, you know, being precise and accurate and apolitical. And you had the Republican nominated justices like Scalia or Thomas using Frank Luntz language, partial birth abortion, in the opinions. I mean, we were a generation behind on the left or more behind Republicans in the Federalist Society and Leonard Leo and sort of stacking the federal courts. And so when demand justice sort of came about in 2017, I almost felt this is what I was working with NARAL, like the sense of relief that finally an organization, and I think NARAL was doing this well too, finally an organization was like speaking openly and truthfully about what was going on with the judiciary and was not sort of talking in like laborious, like, you know, elitist terms about the sacrosanct institution. I mean, the Republicans have been treating this as a political fight for a generation, and we as Democrats or progressives just had not been. And so one of the things that most appealed to me to demand justice's work was that willingness to be blunt and transparent about how the fight for the judiciary, Supreme Court on down, was political, but then also push Democrats who, you know, we're sort of clinging to norms and, you know, comedy, C-O-M-I-T-Y, in the Senate, and sort of a belief that our democratic institutions would sort of like protect themselves, and not realize that if we want to protect our rights, if we want to fight for these institutions, you know, if we want them to protect us, we actually have to fight to protect them. This was sort of like my slug in interviewing for this job, was that I worked for Harry Reid in sort of high-level Democratic politics before I ever stepped foot in law school. And so the idea that judiciary and these nomination fights weren't another institution that we had to fight to protect, that we couldn't just trust, you know, the jig was sort of up by the time I stepped into law school. So that was why demand justice was so appealing to me. I think that you're absolutely right that the Obama administration, like, blew it on judges. And to me, the sort of I think the moment or the incident that sort of crystallized to me everything that was wrong with the Democratic approach to judges was when Justice Scalia died and when President Obama nominated Merrick Garland as his replacement, knowing that Mitch McConnell was saying, well, we're not going to confirm anybody with the election coming up November. And, you know, so Obama was basically making a choice of whoever we're nominating is essentially a message choice, right? We're trying to send a signal to who Democrats believe should sit on the Supreme Court. And rather than nominating someone who had a clear record of protecting civil rights, had a clear record of protecting worker and union rights and standing up to corporations, he chose someone that I think he and his political advisors would make the Democrats look reasonable on judges. And, you know, that strategy was not only a failed one, but it has an audience of no people, right? And
well, that's what I was going to ask. Like, to whom? Like,
correct.
Who is it that's out there that is going, well, it's absurd that Mitch McConnell's not, like, Merrick Garland is very temperate. He's got a total judicial temper.
Right, right. It's like as if the case that had to be made was that Mitch McConnell was unreasonable. It's like it's the argument, like, we don't need to prove that Mitch McConnell was unreasonable. We have to defeat Mitch McConnell and win the fights that Mitch McConnell is engaging in. And to me, that to me was the epitome of the everything that's wrong in how the Democratic Party has approached the judiciary for generations. And so my agenda now with demand justice is, you know, we've already seen, you know, in Trump 2.0, I think in Trump, you know, the first Trump administration, he did the sort of standard thing of outsourcing the nominations to Leonard Leo and the Federalist Society. You know, they had Republican nominee.
I know this, but remind people who the Federalist Society is and who Leonard Leo is, because I don't think people, you know, I mean, you can imagine every couple of weeks I'm talking about this, but I don't think it can be said enough. There is nothing equivalent, even remotely equivalent. There was an attempt at one point, like I'd say 10 years ago, to do the AJS, and that ended up like almost backfiring. Like, the Federalist Society, you need to join the Federalist Society as a conservative in law school. They do. If you want any future, you cannot be appointed to the judiciary unless you are a member of this society. It's the one that Barry Weiss is now famously went and spoke to and said, I know you're against my marriage because I'm gay, but we all want tax cuts. I mean, that speaks about both parties in that instance. Yeah. But Just remind everybody who Leonard Leo is in the Federalist Society.
So I would say, sort of equate the Federalist Society, and the, your way you're describing is actually right, is absolutely right. It's like it is basically the if the road to the if the Supreme Court is the major leagues, right? The Federalist Society is the whole farm system where you have to join in the sort of you start in the farm leagues and you play single A ball and then double A ball and triple A ball. Joining Federalist Society is the path upward if you ever as a law student and a practicing lawyer, if you ever want to be nominated to a federal judgeship and, you know, to others too, but they essentially raise political lawyers from, you know, pups to be not just sort of legal thinkers, but to sort of dual track them as like political mercenaries and jurists at the same time. And you sort of see the evolution of this in the last couple Supreme Court nominations from Trump is they are extremely good. They are very, very almost, you know, they are almost geniuses at being able to talk in legal terms in a way that masks political ideology to try and achieve some far right, you know, extremist goal, some very pro corporate goal. The Federalist Society is essentially, if you want in, if you want any chance of being a federal judge nominated by a Republican president, you have to join the Federalist Society. You have to, you know, you basically have to follow their ideology. Leonard Leo is essentially its head and has been, I think, the singular figure in Republican politics and nominations to the federal judiciary going back several Republican presidents now. He is the point person, right? And so he and the Federalist Society see the vacancies on the federal bench. They, you know, I'm sure they encourage existing Republican nominated judges on the federal bench to take senior status, to retire. They have an inventory of what the vacancies are. And then they essentially create lists and manifests of who they want to appoint to those judgeships. And Republican White Houses have traditionally outsourced this whole project to Leonard Leo because he's basically built an outsourced farm system for these judges. And so what you have is a combination of people who have either far right credentials or corporate credentials or some combination of far right and corporate credentials who they can place, depending on, you know, the makeup of the Senate, on these federal benches. And it has been this way for a very long time. And in Trump's first term, it was sort of the standard that way, right? They did it that normal way, and you know they said the right things on the corporate issues. They said the right thing on the sort of individual rights, the gay marriage and on reproductive rights, where they sort of hedged enough, you know, that they wouldn't be called out on it explicitly. What's interesting is I think that actually Roberts was the last, and as they've gotten more brazen, as this has become more successful. And as Democrats have not fought back, the nominees, if you could see the evidence of this in the hearings, as they've gotten more successful, the nominees have actually answered less as they realize they can get away with answering less. I believe, and I'm sure someone will check, I believe that John Roberts was the last SCOTUS nominated by a Republican to actually defend Brown v. Board on the merits. Right. He actually sort of endorsed, well, yes, separate but equal is inherently unequal. He was the and since then, they've realize they don't even have to answer those questions. They can just sort of duck those questions. This has been it is one of the most successful institutional political projects that the right wing has and has built over generations. And to your point, Democrats have had nothing in response, and not just institutionally nothing, but they haven't even sort of talked about or treated the judiciary as a political entity that has to be fought for in order to preserve either the rights that already exist or the progress that we make legislatively and electorally.
There's a couple of things that come to mind. One is that Trump was able to place somewhere around 260 people on the federal judiciary to lifetime appointments, which was record breaking up to that point, because there were so many that were empty from the Obama years because it was not considered a priority, both as a policy matter and as a political matter.
Yes.
And those two things go hand in hand.
Yes.
The blue slips that were ignored under, and the blue slip is just an old tradition in the Senate where the senators from a certain state have to basically give their sign off to any potential judicial nominee from that, that may be in that circuit court or in those district courts. And if they don't, if they hold their blue slip back, they don't even have to make a proactive argument against it.
And blue slips were respected regardless of the party, right? So in other words, even if it was a Republican nominee and there was one from the Seventh Circuit today on passed through Senate Judiciary, and Tammy Baldwin from Wisconsin did not return the blue slip, they ignored it. They sort of voted to move this.
Democrats respected the blue slip.
Yes, correct.
Even after the Republicans had ignored it under Trump won.
Correct.
And then they went back, and the big thing that I think it was at the time, was it from Vermont, I can't remember his name, the Senator Leahy, was like, we're going to reinstitute blue slips. And as if like the whole country was like, thank God, we've returned to normalcy. Right.
Electorally, when you look at the issues, when people really like, the difference between a regular voter and an irregular voter getting off the couch and voting is like, does this candidate support the blue slip system?
And then of course, as soon as the Republicans take control again, blue slips are ignored
out the
by
window.
Democrats.
Right. Of course, and this is like, out the window. And this is like, this obviously follows a pattern in the Democratic caucus generally, and especially in the Senate, where like, you know, I think this is sort of indicative of what I would call the post Harry Reid Senate in the Democratic caucus, like. You know, to the extent that, you know, they still existed under Harry Reid, there was some notion that you can't, like, if the norms were getting away, getting in, if sort of norms and procedures were getting in the way of achieving our ideological gains in sort of, you know, if they were used improperly, if they were used unfairly, and they're like, there was at least some notion that, like, maybe they shouldn't exist anymore. And you saw this when Harry Reid used the nuclear option to be able to confirm district court judges with 50 plus under Obama, because he was so frustrated that not only was Obama not nominating enough, that the Republicans were filibustering all of them. Like, Harry Reid actually sort of, and, you know, he took a lot of flack from all the normies at the time for using the nuclear option to be able to confirm Obama's district lower court nominations on district court and circuit court judges with just 51 votes instead of 60. But there's none of that now in the Democratic caucus.
No. So let's talk about where we are. And someone just asked, is there a progressive or liberal version of the Federalist Society? And again, like I say, the AGAS, I think it was the American
ACS, the American Constitution Society,
attempted and has yet to really sort of like develop that type of thing. There really is nothing equivalent even remotely close. And the only thing that comes, you know, like, it seems to me that Demand Justice is doing like one part of that job, which is sort of the training and educating the senators in particular, or hoping to, and getting Democrats to understand whether they are rank and file, whether they are lawmakers or voters. This is important. I mean, right now, the only thing standing between the full deployment of, you know, military in these places, in this instance, it happens to be a judge appointed by Ronald Reagan, I think it was. But largely speaking, if Joe Biden, one of the things he deserves credit for, and a lot of this is a function, frankly, of Demand Justice.
The pressure from the left, absolutely.
The pressure that came in. Joe Biden put 250 some odd justices on the court. And it was also justices that came that were sociologically, economically, legally.
Correct.
And, you know, it wasn't just a question of identity.
It wasn't just all corporate lawyers, right, from white shoe firms.
It was defense attorneys. It was antitrust lawyers. It was
Dale Ho was a voting rights attorney from the ACLU and now sits on a district court in New York.
Yes, that was a huge innovation, it seems to me.
I think there's sort of two problems, and I want to sort of talk about the macro problem for a second, because I think there's a chicken and egg thing. And one of them is, you know, the problem, I think, in this is having fallen a generation behind. You know, I think the senators look at the Democratic base and see that they just have not been as activated and don't care about the courts over the years as much as the Republican base has. And so they've been less reactive on these things because they don't think they have to, because they don't think they're going to get pressure from the base if they're crappy on judges. And I think, you know, and I think on the right, you see the aggressive corporate you know, the corporate actors who know that they need pro-corporate judges in order to sort of externalize all their costs, right? So they're, so that, you know, to strike down regulations so they don't have to pay to clean up their own pollution. You know, they, there is a financial gain for them in investing right. in organizations that build a right-wing judiciary. And there hasn't been that kind of, like, they almost have like a fiduciary responsibility to corrupt the judiciary, right? And there just hasn't been that kind of a incentive structure on the left. And I think, so I, there's a bit of a chicken and egg thing of like, at what point are we sort of, who's going to sort of take the lead? And so Demand Justice has sort of like, has a couple of different projects ahead of us. One of them is just, you know, is making sure that we get to, and I think that, you know, I'm sort of, I want to sort of say like normie Dem base is aware of how much the judiciary is at stake, how much it matters, how much it's a political fight, because Democrats have been treating it as like an academic fight for too long, right? And so there's sort of this weird feedback loop. So we actually have to have Democratic activists demand that their senators fight for the judiciary. The second is that, to your point about who are we nominating, what are these, like, what is the make of these courts? Obama, like, President Biden deserves a lot of credit. And if you remember Demand Justice at the beginning of the Biden administration when he was elected,
had a list.
Not just had a list, but started a campaign demanded that the new incoming Biden administration not appoint a single federal judge from a who is a corporate lawyer. Now, yep. do I think that Demand Justice thought that the Biden administration was going to follow that to the T? Probably not. But I think Ron Klain and the Biden administration understood that that gave them space. You know, they were being pushed in, that gave them space to appoint, like you were saying, people who were, I don't know, public defenders, voting rights attorneys, right? And so that moved the whole conversation. So there's a couple things. We have to sort of activate, we have to, you know, for all the people that are outraged at whatever the assault on the rights are, the invasion of the National Guard, the deportations, the, you know, the Fifth Circuit ruled a few weeks ago, a Trump judge of the Fifth Circuit ruled the NLRB was like in, like blanket unconstitutional in favor of Elon Musk and SpaceX, right? Nobody said a peep about that. So we actually have to sort of, our job is to sort of connect people and how their rights and their sort of the, you know, how corporations are screwing them, how their rights are being taken away. All that leads back to a judiciary that the Democrats have not been fighting for a generation. And I think the second thing is we have to move. So part of that, we have to move the conversation to demand that Democrats actually do things that they have been, one, uncomfortable doing, because there is a, they want to sort of all get along and not, you know, plant their feet and make things awkward in the caucus whenever possible, and no more so than on the Senate Judiciary Committee. And two, you know, get Democrats and activists and progressive activists to hold them accountable when they don't. And I think one of the, you know, we can sort of talk about what happened last week, but I think in Trump 1, you know, he was breaking the law. And I think the urgency here in the second Trump administration is he's sort of systematically dismantling not just the rule of law, but all the institutions that uphold the rule of law. You saw, you know, he's going after law firms and getting them to sort of capitulate. That was intentional, right? That was intentional. And Demand Justice, you know, this spring launched a campaign called Big Law Cowards to call them out for doing it, right? We degrade everyone's rights. We sort of shift the power towards the powerful when we don't fight back against the right-wing takeover of the judiciary and the rule of law.
Let's talk about what your action is right now that you're looking to do and why.
Yeah, so one of the things that we saw when in Trump 2 is every single judge who's nominated for the federal bench under Trump has to essentially take a loyalty pledge. This is unlike it was in Trump 1. Because every one of the senators is asking about who won or lost the 2020 election and what happened on January 6th. And if you are to be in Trump's favor, and unlike the first administration, he announces all these nominations on Truth Social. People don't know about him ahead of time. So it's clear that he's looking at every single one of these federal judicial nominations very closely. Every single one, in order to be nominated by Trump, you cannot have said that he lost the 2020 election, and you cannot be truthful about what happened on January 6th. So every single one of these judges, in every one of them has been asked.
And just to be clear, this is not a comedy routine that you're saying. This is actually true.
Correct.
Like, you literally have to make sure that your record on in any public discourse
yes.
and in any
and
type
when
of hearing,
asked in this process. You cannot say that Trump lost the 2020 election. And to the extent where you see every one of them has essentially the same language in their written questions, it's like they're out is, well, officially the House certified Biden as the winner, which is not did he win. It just says that this third party said he won. right? And then on January 6th, they say some version of, well, I'm weighing in on a political matter and there's active litigation about the pardons, which is like mostly not true. They can't, because we know those are the two things that Trump, you know, if you on the wrong side of those things, you are done with Trump. And I think it's funny because can you imagine any single one of these nominees in a hearing, if they're asked the question, who lost the 2020 election? If they said Donald Trump lost the 2020 election, everybody who pays attention to politics, everybody knows that their nomination would be yanked the same day. They would be done, right? And so yet we have all of these people being nominated to federal judgeships at a time when he's weaponizing the DOJ. He's like, he's initiating these revenge prosecutions against his political enemies. And last week, we saw Senate Democrats on the Judiciary Committee, six of them last week, and now Hirono today, more, have voted to approve these judges and report them out favorably to the floor. And none of these people can say that Trump lost the 2020 election. And to me, that means they're politically compromised. Why? Like, so we launched an ad campaign. We're spending six figures, and we're going to increase the—
Why are they doing this?
That's a great question.
Like what? Like what is, I mean, the
part of it is log rolling. Like part of them like might want the, you know, might need the vote of one of these home state senators in the future. I think part of them like want to look like they're bipartisan some way. But as a result, they're enabling Trump to lower the bar of what constitutes as qualified. They're essentially enabling the authoritarianism by saying these judges are qualified when they have to take political loyalty oaths. And like, here's the thought. Here's the sort of a experiment here. None of them yet were like none of them were nominees to the Eastern District of Virginia, where the hack Lindsey Halligan is prosecuting Jim Comey.
Yes.
Imagine if one of these nominees was being nominated to a district court where Trump had fired the United States attorney for refusing to prosecute his political attorneys, his political enemies, had put in a crony like Lindsey Halligan to file BS charges against his political enemies, and you had a judge presiding over that case in row.
It's all a racket.
You cannot say that
it's completely rigged.
2020 election. It's a banana republic at this point.
Yeah.
And here's the thing. Yes, some of they weren't appointed to the Eastern District of Virginia, but a couple of them were appointed to district courts in Alabama. Imagine if one of Trump's enemies was Doug Jones, was former right. Senator Doug Jones. Like, you can't. There is no moral, historical, or frankly, political rationalization for voting for any of these judges.
And the reason why seven Democratic senators and more will sign off on these is because there is no political price for them to pay.
Correct.
To do it. And it's the easiest. I mean, this is the way they always make decisions, right? It's like, okay, there's some marginal benefit. I might need a favor from somebody, whatever it is. And there's no price to pay. So that's it. That's right. The equation.
And imagine 20 years from now when we're looking back at these votes in Senate Judiciary Committee where, you know, Peter Welch was one of the first and he gave this quote about, well, I found a needle in a haystack. I found a Trump judge that was qualified. Qualified to do what, right? This guy had a very scant record. He came from the Central District of Florida. I believe he was the son of a lobbyist who had defended police misconduct cases. Like, because they lack any smoking gun in their overt record does not mean that, like, you are participating in the sort of shrinking down of what constitutes qualified because Trump is so bad. Like, that's enabling.
And there's no, again, there's no price to pay. So the idea is make it costly for these Democratic senators to cast this vote. Make them feel like there is a downside to making these votes because people are paying attention to it. And so what is the current campaign that you guys are doing?
So the first campaign we launched last week, we're spending, you know, six figures. We're targeting both Durbin, who's the ranking member, and Chris Coons, who's a longtime member of the Judiciary Committee and has been sort of on the opposite side of some demand justice campaigns in the past. Billboards and digital ads in their home states and online, basically asking them, like, what are they thinking? Right? They voted to capitulate to
Why
Trump.
Why is Durbin, of all people, doing? Isn't he retiring?
I don't know. I mean, I think maybe to give cover to other Dems on the committee. I just don't know. And we saw even Schiff in California vote for one of them, like vote one of them favorably off the committee last week. And so today we're going to expand that to a couple more senators. We saw, you know, Sheldon Whitehouse from Rhode Island, Amy Klobuchar from Minnesota, Mazie Hirono, sadly, from Hawaii, even voted one off favorably. And I think one of the things, the funny thing is last week when they did this, they had talked, some of these senators who did this had talked earlier in the committee, like moments earlier, bemoaning the weaponization of the DOJ to prosecute Comey, and then turned around moments later and voted for these judges who could not say that Trump lost the 2020 election. And so, like, part of this is going back to this whole notion of, like, thinking through the Obama nominating Garland for the Supreme Court of it all, right, is that part of this is that if they're going to sort of send these angry tweets, if they're going to go on cable news, like calling Trump an authoritarian, you can't then in the sort of confines of the Judiciary Committee when you're sitting next to your Republican colleagues and it's sort of all friendly and you're sort of arguing about norms, like you can't then vote for his judges, right? You actually have, if you're going to, you have to act honestly, you have to act consistently with what is going on in the world outside with the attacks on the DOJ. You can't have it both ways. You can't sort of like try and show some bipartisanship and at the same time say the sky is falling because Trump is attacking the rule of law.
Right. And the idea is, on some level, reflective of what's happening now with the government shutdown.
That's
people
right.
are paying attention.
That's
the
right.
Democrats are signaling this is not normal. What's going on here? The president is, you know, trying to unilaterally cut the budget. There's no point in saying it. Like, it creates an awareness of what the issue is because people need to be engaged with the courts and with the idea that yep. every judicial nominee is going to have implications down the road, maybe next week for that matter, or 6 months from now or whatnot. And even more so when we have a president who is assaulting the foundations of, I mean, the judiciary, it's... Yes.
I mean, on some level, I didn't expect to have to do this so quickly after I took over Dementia. I mean, on some level, I feel like it's almost absurd that we're having to do this, that we're having to call on these, we have to sort of put pressure on these Democrats for voting for these Trump judges. I'm a little gobsmacked about it. I mean, I guess I should never overestimate the Democratic Senate caucus, or at least some of them. But to me, this is, I can't believe that we have to do this. And I can't believe, and I think especially, look, you're going to say, people are going to say, well, why are you going after Dems? You should be going after Republicans. Like, here's the thing. There is, it's not just sort of a historical and moral argument for doing it this way. There's an election coming up next year. And one of the biggest problems Democrats have now that they need to sort of work on is they are seen by the general voting public as incapable of going to D.C. and taking on the big fights and reforming the institutions so that government serves people better. They are not seen as people who are strong on taking on the fights for reform. And so part of this is in their own political interest to actually be consistent and plant their feet and do their job, right? This isn't just a moral question. This isn't just a historical question. There's like a political imperative here to actually standing up to Trump.
Josh Orton, we'll put a link to Demand Justice.
Demandjustice.org.
People can go there, support your organization, support your work, petitions, and also you'll get cues as to which senators you should be calling and saying, how are you? Like, I know there's people, I've been seeing it in our IMs. People are like, what? Mazie Hirono or any Democrat is voting for Trump's nominees? People just aren't aware of it. And I'm glad you're in a position now to help raise people's awareness. And we'll talk again soon.
Yeah, I hope. And next time, let's get a little better spot on the program, Sam. Maybe a little earlier in the show.
Yes, we'll upgrade. And I'm sorry. It's very hard to find.
We'll talk about it later.
It's hard to find help around here.
Then understand.
We'll get to the
understand.
All right. Thanks, Josh.
Thank you, Sam.
All right, folks. Before we go into the fun half, let's bring on another former producer of the program. This is the most former producer. Well, Brandon. That's not Brandon. What? Oh, we don't have Bender yet?
It's normal.
What is he doing? Brandon Sutton. Welcome.
He's not on here yet.
Hold all right,
on.
Let's bring it.
You're not on. Brandon, you're not. We can't hear him yet.
We can't hear you.
No.
Oh, that's too bad. What's going on? In a moment, Brandon Sutton will be joining us. I see him. Wisconsin Disco just said, can't wait for Brian to go on to lead the Southern Poverty Law Center.
Nice, nice.
There he is, cool. Brandon there Sutton.
I'm here. I was starting to think I was a hallucination.
I honestly, I don't know what was going on, but...
I was sending out resumes.
And where's Bender? He's just going to... Okay, all right, we got Bender in here. We got one more former producer of the Majority Report to join the show. Number three of the day is going to join us. Yeah. Here he is.
You're a kingmaker, Sam.
We just fire people. Why is it messed up? Because of me. Oh, because you're used to having that other
different
camera.
Layers. Don't worry about it.
There we go. There we go. All right. Matt Bender, Brandon Sutton. It's Thursday, and Emma is out today, so sadly you have her substitute. Why don't you guys, Brandon, tell me what's happening on the discourse before we go to the break.
Yes, so today we checked out Pam Bondi's escapades in front of Congress, and tomorrow we will be diving
deep. Was that her crying in the background?
No, she'd never do that. And tomorrow, I don't know if you have been keeping up with the adventures of Patrick Bet-David, but he had the foremost expert on the dustification of the Twin Towers on 9/11, on to discuss what really happened to the Twin Towers, Dr. Judy Wood. And so us on the discourse will be asking a sort of, I guess, meta question of what happened to the quality of the Patrick Bet-David podcast. While also, I guess, finding out the true nature of what happened on 9/11. So join us.
Answered at the simultaneously. We need to get some of that footage and examine it. I actually think that Patrick Bad David could be a hologram by now. So that could be. Matt Bender.
How are you?
What's going on your like multiple podcasts that you do?
I'll keep it short. Just tune in tonight, 8:30 p.m. at youtube.com/MattBender for Leftist Mafia.
And you got to keep those kids quiet.
Yeah, I know.
All right. We're going to take a break, head into the fun half. Just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member, join the majorityreport.com. Also, Just Coffee. .coop, fair trade coffee, hot chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. Matt, Left Reckoning.
Yeah, Left Reckoning, we had a show, Michael Aravalo, talking about a guy stealing valor in the Rogan manosphere. Also,
what is going on with our society? It's just like, this is...
what kind of valor?
I remember when valor meant
podcaster valor?
No,
justification proper, of valor.
Proper military valor. Saying I had a medal I had a bronze medal of honor with valor. Somebody asked him, "Do you have one of those with valor?" And he's like, "Yep." And the cool thing about saying things "yep" instead of "yes" is like it's faster. So like the lie, you might be able to get out there with the lie. And then Justin Chen, who represents union workers for the federal government, particularly at the EPA, talking about the shutdown. So check that out, folks.
All right, folks, quick break, then fun half.
3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What?
What is that going on? It's nuts. Wait a second. Hold on for a second.
The Majority Report.
Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt.
Who?
What is up, everyone? Nomi Key.
You did it. Let's go, Brandon.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women's...
Stop talking a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But, dude, you want to smoke this...
7A?
Yes.
Hi, me? You're safe?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
is you.
If it's me. Hello, is this me?
Think it is you. Who is you?
No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm going to go smell it.
Who libertarians?
They're so stupid, though.
Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say.
857-210-35-501.
One half.
3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Poop.
You can call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about yeah. you is just like every day, all day, like yeah. everything you do.
Without a doubt.
Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the weak being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled,
wow.
folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.
Back.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the majority part. Emma Vigeland is out today.
Can't believe
it. Is a non-Emma majority report. With
no girls allowed.
Matt Binder and Brandon Sutton. Yes, total.
Yes. I can smell the testosterone.
It's guys
I can smell
night.
It.
Yeah. Oh
my Making God. Me heady.
What smells like soy around here with three?
Well,
three
well,
limbs. It's a bunch of soy boys all, around here.
It's all the extra soy that is currently not being sold to China. That is
the whole country smells like soy.
Yeah,
the whole country smells like
well,
soy.
That may be a good place to start. I think we got a couple of clips, or do we not? Do we not have our farmer clips? No, we don't. All right. Yeah, we got a bunch of those. You know what? Let's start with this, because otherwise we're going to forget about it. I just want to start about, do you guys know who this Oklahoma former
yes.
superintendent of schools?
Yep.
Okay. Walters?
Brandon especially knows. Okay. He did a deep dive, Brandon.
Yes.
Brandon, yes. Tell us about Ryan Walters, because it sounds like you might not have him to kick around for too much longer.
Well, so I want to say on the discourse, and I say this every time, we've been on this Ryan Walters beat since the beginning. He started off as a teacher in Oklahoma schools, and then he became the superintendent a few years ago. And since he became the superintendent, he's been embroiled in controversies, largely related to his desire to be like this online influencer type MAGA figure. So you might remember him as the guy who partnered with the country music singer to bring Trump Bibles to Oklahoma City schools, or the
Lee
guy
Greenwood.
Who partnered with PragerU. Yeah, Lee Greenwood, the guy who partnered with PragerU, the guy who brought libs of TikTok into Oklahoma City schools. He did a lot of those things.
I specifically remember we did a video on this guy when he was talking about something about like he didn't want to politicize. He said something about slavery. I can't remember exactly what it was. And I said, this guy's a fascist. And then going on some Stitch and Styles or whatever that show is, and they were mad because I had lied to my audience about that guy. I can't remember what that show is. But
Stitch and Adam or whatever.
I think so. Yes.
And, Lilo and
like,
Stitch.
One guy's a cartoon figure or something. I don't know. Maybe I'm, right. maybe I'm going senile. Yeah. But I did. That was the first time I remember this guy, and he had said something about slavery that was like really off. Maybe it was in the books they were getting from PragerU. I don't remember.
Yeah, I think that might have been from one of those PragerU videos that said that slaves were better off being slaves in America than being like free in Africa, because look where they ended up in the freest right. country. You know, one of those PragerU videos. Most recently, he became, you know, prominent in the news because of the incident that occurred during a public student council meeting, or I guess board of ed meeting, in Oklahoma, where naked images were displayed on the smart TV behind him while they were having a meeting. This caused a lot of controversy and also a multi-agency investigation into the nude images on the TV, which resulted in no charges being filed against him. But he did resign.
So wait a second. And so the Antifa, fighters who placed those images on his TV were right. never caught?
No, they were never caught, but they were successful in their ultimate goal of getting him to resign. But turns out that as a Trump-adjacent Republican MAGA kind of figure in public office, he might not have been doing as well with administering to the state. Seems like there might have been money that was going into places that it might not should have been going into. And since he's resigned and, you know, people don't like him very much, they're kind of auditing his activities while
clip.
He was in office.
This is number 18. I'm sure if he was doing something wrong, we would hear about an investigation.
Lawmakers say normalcy is needed at the Department of Education. Some normalcy came as Educators Hall of Fame was put back up at the Department of Education Wednesday afternoon after what many consider a controversial reign under Ryan Walters.
Wants Oklahoma to be the first state to put Bibles back in schools.
From the new social studies standards making false claims about the 2020 election, giving teachers transferring from blue states the America First test. Changes, though, have already happened. This is the Department of Education website. This was September 22nd. When you scroll down, you saw a lot. Office of Religious Liberty, school choice links. And then when you clicked on this, Story of America, it took you to those social studies standards that were controversial. The test teachers had to take, naturalization test. It also had several other links, including the PragerU partnership links. Now, let's look at this website. This is the current Department of Education website. It looks similar, but none of the links to the America site that had PragerU as this teacher of the year thing, a school choice link.
Oh, gross.
Other than that,
teacher
it has a
of
lot
the
of
year?
Changes compared to when Walters ran. Reverend Dr. Shannon Fleck has been long outspoken against what she calls Walters' Christian nationalism.
Most atrocious, but his implementation of Bibles in public schools, specifically the Trump Bible.
Fleck is also a part of a lawsuit fighting back against the new social studies standards. Those are on hold in the courts until the next court date.
What do we give
for
each one of those
units?
We
very much need to go back over his tenure.
Shauna Montwright represents educators. She says, let's get back to before Oklahoma was 50th in education.
Oklahoma social studies teachers were chosen again, and they wrote what they wrote.
While updates to the website's Wednesday show a glimpse of that change, it could be costly and take some time. And just before this show, the Attorney General Gintner Drummond, who is running for governor in that campaign right now, but his office just requested a state audit of the Department of Education.
Attorney General Gintner Drummond says the audit would focus on Ryan Walters' tenure as state school superintendent. In a letter to the Oklahoma State Auditor, Drummond cited concerns raised by current and former Education Department staff regarding spending practices under Walters' leadership. Period would cover the time from when Walters took office on January 9th, 2023 to September 30th of this year.
Who could have imagined that the Christian nationalism that coming in was all sort of like some type of scam that was also going in the background? Just to give folks a taste, let's just pop up just one part of the PragerU curriculum for children in social studies. Check this out, just so that people have a small taste of what this is.
Slavery is as old as time and has taken place in every corner of the world, even amongst the people I just left. Being taken as a slave is better than being killed, no? Before you judge, you must ask yourself, what did the culture and society of the time treat as no big deal? Slavery is...
That, incidentally, that is...
That is
Christopher Columbus on the boat saying slavery is a no big deal.
I feel so much smarter already. I can't believe that Oklahoma's 50th in education with a curriculum like that. That's because of those woke DEI standards the Obama Biden cabal put in. Like, but once now Trump's in charge, they're going to shoot up to the top.
So I assume that this clip didn't cut right before the part where like Columbus was arrested for brutality, and there were people at the time like, what was this, Francisco de Bombadilla documenting atrocities, like.
Well, what are you talking about?
He was arrested in the 1500s for colonial brutality.
Yeah.
Yes, but do you have to? I will tell you this: it is because it was so woke. Yeah. Back in the early 1500s, when people
woke.
Yes, it was too woke.
It was
at
a
that
woke
time.
Period. Yeah.
The king was a DEI hire.
Boys are walking around. My God, it would be really funny, except for the fact, like, there are huge segments of our population that are being taught this. Like, in Florida schools, that's where that video comes from. What? That's not a snippet from, South Park. That's, like,
Ron DeSantis approved.
Fed to kids in schools.
To be fair, though, I think the... I was going to say, to be fair, though, I do think the primary consumers of PragerU kids content are like adults. They are adults who like try to convince themselves that this is the front lines of the propaganda war for like the minds and hearts of children. But it is still upsetting that they share this with kids, even if it is probably being laughed at by our nation's youths.
I mean, some are. But like, what percentage of kids taking this seriously and just assuming they're in school, this is the real stuff? Like, what percentage becomes like terrifying?
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, you hear like we're joking about it because it is very funny, obviously. But you hear exactly what that PragerU Christopher Columbus has said from people who make that argument. Like, that's a seriously made argument. That, you know, slavery wasn't, I agree, slavery wasn't a good thing, but it was better than this or better than that. They were at least given a home and fed a meal. They weren't homeless, at least.
And
you
we could have brought the big pox, but instead we brought a smallpox. So it wasn't so bad.
We live in an administration that treats pedophilia like it's no big deal right now, currently. Exactly. It doesn't make it not a big deal.
I do think the conspiracy theorist in me does feel like part of this curriculum is getting Americans primed for like techno-feudalism. See, like, it's not as bad. It's not as bad as being a slave, just working in the lithium mines.
You could be dead.
Yeah, you could have been dead. Do you want scurvy? No. Okay. So you're fine.
I do like that they have to do an investigation into whether he misused school funds, as if we didn't just watch that very thing.
Yeah, exactly. As if there's something that gets worse than that. I just want to say, like, it's the fun half. This type of rampant speculation would never happen except for in the fun half. But I think we should get a pool together as to the chances that part of the investigation is going to involve paying people through that he met through websites. I get the sense you just don't have this level of of Christian nationalism and sort of like relentless sort of like run. He is running away from something. Let's put it this way: that is inside him that he cannot run away from. And these guys, when there starts to be investigations about the way money's spent, I have a feeling it's going to be like involving. Well, what's this picture? Oh, that is. Oh, this is his college.
It's just a post from a local blog called The Lost Ogle, just of a photo of Ryan.
With, okay.
One of
there
his friends.
Yes.
That's how we all hang out. That's how Matt and I produce.
If you could just go look a pan toward the sandals, Brian. I think
that's boys' time. That's just boys' time. So
Sunday school.
Yeah, the shoe in. But
well, I will say he did react very weird during that whole saga, the whole arc where he was accused of having naked ladies on his television. It was a very, very bizarre set of circumstances. But in this particular case, I don't think they're trying to lodge that the money was spent improperly on PragerU, despite that necessarily, I think, being the case. Would it surprise you to hear that he might have been giving sweetheart deals to friends he knew for jobs, high-paying jobs in Oklahoma? And might it surprise you that many of those friends didn't even come to Oklahoma?
Wow.
Well, and at least not consistently.
You know what else would not surprise me? If they were very handsome buddies who were very cut. And with
did he fly
apps.
To them for educational training?
No, I think these were just more standard types of grifts, just like your local, you know, self-dealing types. But who's to say?
I think self-dealing, I hope, is a euphemism.
I think there needs to be an investigation. I believe in law and order. I believe in justice.
I'll tell you what I'm also encouraged by. Just that the website,
yes.
Like it makes me believe that the people of Oklahoma are not as far gone as I thought before. I mean, because, you know, you see, like, how is there not an open revolt that PragerU is now like replacing actual academics? And so it's good to see that there are still like people in Oklahoma who care about, you know, sort of education, like actual education.
Right.
That's healthy. Let's see. What else?
We got another clip.
And we got another clip here. Oh, here we go. Wait, this is the Charlie Kirk thing? Or what is the... What's the press gasps? We're not going to do that part?
No, oh, well, don't.
Have you guys been following this? Apparently, Candace Owens and Tucker Carlson have some theories about the assassination of Charlie Kirk. Now, let's be clear. We have not heard a single thing out of that investigation. Has there been a single, like, official word on this for 3 weeks, 4 weeks?
There must be just so many ties to so many various leftist groups that they just can't put them all on paper yet.
Yeah.
It's got to be,
the nexus. Well,
Cash Patel likes to, you know, run a pretty buttoned-down operation.
Yeah, exactly. He wouldn't leak stuff. Not while they're investigating. Probably also not to tip off, like, all of the former girlfriends of the founder of Antifa. Because, of course, you don't want to let them know you're on their trail. But here is Dinesh D'Souza with Dave Rubin. These guys are really they're getting mad about what's going on with Tucker Carlson and Candace Owens.
The shoe's on the other foot a little bit here.
And wait a second. We just want to be clear. Do we know if this is a paid post?
We don't.
If they're both getting 7,000 separately, do they get 14,000 for this one post, or they split 7,000?
Can you double like invoice for the same? Yeah, go ahead.
That's what I'm asking.
You know, I have a connection with her going back, but we have to remember that the Tucker and the Candace that we loved. We loved for different reasons. They built their reputation on other issues. They have both taken this dark turn. We didn't tell them to do it. They chose to do it. And Candace follows the strategy of the bogus investigation. Now,
Wait a second.
Wait, whoa.
Dinesh D'Souza.
The director of 2,000 Mules?
Was he sued? I'm trying to remember. Wait a second. Now, I know he went to jail for illegally funneling campaign contributions through essentially cutouts. Did he ever get sued over the Dominion thing? Or did he? Oh, no, he had to apologize because, here it is. Pop this up. 2000 Mules creator admits some of the claims are flawed, he had to say. Now, he had to say this because I think if you come down, like, he was going to get sued. And they said, yeah, go ahead. That's go ahead.
No, that was just because there were actually even more mules, Sam. That's just like woke propaganda.
Was it with the mules supposedly, were they like in the server? Were they the ones who ran the server? That's the way the servers were powered, by 2,000 mules inside of it, or?
I mean, he could be complaining that like Candace Owens is infringing on his copyright of the bogus investigation.
Okay, yeah, let's go back. I mean, this must be very difficult to be an investigator of Dinesh D'Souza's esteem and find out that your colleague is on some type of conspiracy theory wild goose chase.
With her going back. But we have to remember that the Tucker and the Candace that we loved for different reasons. They built their reputation on other issues. They have both taken this dark turn. We didn't tell them to do it. They chose to do it. And Candace follows the strategy of the bogus investigation. Now, to me, this is somewhat embarrassing because in my films, I do investigations. And like Tucker, I like challenging received opinions, but I try to do it in a manner that puts out a bunch of facts, challenges premises, anticipates objections. Whereas what Candace will do is she will put out an extremely incendiary suggestion, like, take a look at this photo. Here's a drain pipe. Maybe a Mossad guy crawled out of it and shot Charlie Kirk.
I'll pause it. You know what I think it's really about? He's like, to monetize my conspiracy theories, I had to hire a film crew. I had to hire an editor. I had to have lighting. I had to rent a studio. And now you can just, this whole time I could have just sat in front of a table and said the whole thing and monetized it. Yeah. That's what he's pissed about.
Yeah, no, for sure. Also, I got to say, this is like a magician revealing like the secrets of another magician. Like those little specials that they had with the masked magician like 20 years ago on Fox. Like this is like that. But he's like just giving up all the tricks.
Go ahead.
Mossad guy, do you have any evidence there was someone who came out of the pipe or the pipe was even accessible?
You don't have evidence it didn't happen.
Exactly. No. Prove it didn't. And then once the theory is capsized, far from any kind of acknowledgement, recognition. So these are investigations that never produce a reliable fact and never come to a conclusion in which one incendiary theory is replaced by another. So Candace is in a certain way mesmerizing. I think she relies on a certain narcotic in which you become addicted to this mode of suspicion. It's almost like deconstructionism for the right, right? Because what is deconstructionism? It's a professional mode of you believe nothing. You take a straightforward sentence.
Incidentally, this is where Dave Rubin had to check out of the conversation because he didn't know what that meant.
Yeah. wait, I believe that.
Deconstruction, is it the no regulation, right? And the deconstruction?
Yeah.
I'm confused. Is there more? Keep going.
So what do you think is actually, without even so specifically talking about the two of them, I mean, what do you think is happening with whatever this thing is on the right that we're referencing? What do you think that is? Because one of the things that I've been doing on this show since Trump got elected is talking about his wins over and over and over. I think the country has, there's such an upside to the country right now. We're fixing so many things, obviously, whether it's the border or the trade deals or trying to get peace in the Middle East or at least trying something different with Ukraine, Russia, and cleaning up our cities. Like, the list goes on, getting woke out of our schools. Like, there's every day there is something new that is positive to talk about. And there's a portion of the right that never talks about that. And what I would want the president to be aware of right now is that those guys are trying to take MAGA out. The thing that created the MAGA that brought in Elon Musk and Joe Rogan and Tulsi and Bobby and me and all these people, that's the thing they're trying to destroy. And I wonder if he's aware of that.
Trump has generally has this approach of sitting on the sidelines and letting it play out a little bit. And I think that's what he's doing right now. Remember when there were bitter battles between like Laura Loomer and Marjorie Taylor Greene? Trump's view is like, all right, just this cat fight, you know, that's right. I'm gonna do other things. Yeah. But you are right that, first of all, this is a gift to radical Islam, because Israel is fighting radical Islam. If you go and you want to break down Israel, break down our alliance with Israel, you are helping the Islamic radicals and the jihadis. There's no other way to look at it. The second thing is...
Tucker Carlson, known co-conspirator with the radical jihadis.
I do love the idea that Trump even knows what's going on at all. Like the idea that he's some like mafioso boss sitting off the side going like, hey, let him fight. No, we literally saw he was asked about Charlie Kirk like 2 days after Charlie Kirk was killed. And he was like, did you see my new ballroom, by the way? It's a beautiful ballroom.
Exactly.
Big trucks. He's checking out those big trucks.
It doesn't directly involve me. So I don't actually even register its existence. Did Tucker they say who? Something about me? It is just unbelievable to be living at this time where Dinesh D'Souza is complaining about
bogus investigations. Yeah,
bogus investigations by conservative talkers.
I thought they were going to cut to a two shot and it would just be a mirror in the other chair.
I mean, he's mad. She's stealing his rubes. He's stealing his rubes, and I think that Tucker Carlson and Candace Owens are very savvy. They saw which way the wind was blowing when it came to Trump becoming the Republican establishment, and they decided to stake their claim as like the new counter Republican establishment.
Yep.
Especially as they saw Trump was going to fail to live up, not just on his like explicitly racist promises, but even on like the other ones, like the most basic ones he's not going to be able to live up to. And they were like, this is a perfect opportunity to monetize dissatisfaction with Trump and to eat into the market share of people like Ben Shapiro, people like Tim Pool, people like Dave Rubin, who, you know, have had it pretty good for a long time. And now they're looking at like losing a lot of their audience to people who are just, you know, pushing people further right.
I mean, I think you mentioned up front that you guys on the Discourse are, you know, have an episode on PBD having a dustification expert from 9/11. We're seeing a lot of that. Like, I think that, like, you know, revisiting 9/11 conspiracy theories, I've seen, like, Tower 7 stuff, like, pop up, like, recently. That is the sort of the Alamo for people who, like, their business model, they feel like is going sideways or something in this space, it feels like. Like, we need to go back to first principles on conspiracy theories and head there. And I think you might be right. I think it's also interesting.
Yeah, I got some Amelia Earhart documents for you.
Yes, we dump those. Let's get as temporally and topically away from Jeffrey Epstein as possible.
Jimmy Hoffa.
Exactly.
I should say, I think they're feeding into like a desire on the far right for a lot more conspiratorial thinking. Like Dinesh D'Souza is right in his analysis of what people on the right are addicted to. He calls it deconstructionism, but they're addicted to feeling like they have secret knowledge. They're addicted to falling down the rabbit holes that, you know, Trump's first term became known for. Like, and he got a lot of them started on that path with like the Obama birtherism stuff. The Obama birtherism, like, pipeline was what broke a lot of the Republicans who are now QAnon's brains at first, right? And so like that's just an addiction that they feed in different ways. And I think 9/11 is a good example of a conspiracy theory that they can latch onto because it's very American-centric. And there are ways in which you can kind of like feed into conspiratorial thinking on 9/11 without actually giving credence to like the things that might have been happening behind the scenes that just further implicate American power, like the Bush administration's relationship with the Saudi Arabian government, you know, Halliburton, things like that. So, you know, I think the right wing sees the utility of these kinds of even more esoteric conspiracies in distracting from like how power actually functions now. And since people's brains are like broken, you know, it's more content.
Also, don't forget that it all ties to the new right and their very separate type of criticism than the left's of Israel. I mean, a lot of the 9/11 conspiracy theories that the right wing are focused on now all come back to Israel, or at least 90% of them. Like, I've seen the conspiracy theories about the dancing Israelis, you know, spread more so than ever before.
Israeli art students. Israeli art students in Mossad. They're also really getting in, latched onto like weather weaponry. Like, that's another big topic that you're seeing coming out of the far right now, as they cope with like climate change having tangible and material consequences that they used to be able to ignore because it still snowed in their part of the world. And so, like, they're just, I think, latching onto a lot of these, like, again, like more extreme conspiracies, not just the Israeli situation, but dustification, like space lasers, chemtrails, like, and, you know, it's not great.
And what is happening with Q? Like, QAnon, like, is it still around? Like, did this sort of like, is this satiating that, is this scratching that itch from the lack of QAnon stuff? Or is that still happening? It's just more underground. I mean, it's sort of fascinating that movement just went away.
It didn't go away. It got reincorporated into the Republican Party. Like, I mean, I think just like with the Tea Party, there are some people who still follow Q specifically, who are still like fully, I guess what they call Q-pilled or whatever, like who are like still true believers in Q. But after so many failed predictions, I think a lot of people just kind of diffused into other conspiracy theory communities, like became just more explicitly anti-vaxxer or got involved in chemtrail nonsense, or they're flat earthers now, or they just believe whole bucket.
Chemtrail what?
Chemtrail nonsense.
Nonsense? Have you not seen?
That's true. That's true. I've seen the sky.
Yeah, I've seen them.
I've seen the patterns in the sky. And they tell you it's clouds, but it's not. It's not clouds. It's the government waging unrestricted warfare.
It's straight lines. How could
it be
a cloud?
Exactly. But yeah, that's what happened to a lot of them.
Since we're talking about conspiracy theories, this is sort of fascinating. And also rather disturbing, because, you know, it's one thing for the right to be chasing conspiracy theories that are taking them down some type of like a rabbit hole. It's another for the top of the Trump regime spreading these things as a way of basically backfilling the authority that they are granting themselves to go after so-called terrorists in this country, domestic terrorists. The NP7 edict about who is guilty of insurrection. Trump is supposedly trying to invoke the Insurrection Act. We know that there are, he's threatening to deploy military personnel to various cities. He's certainly like done that with the National Guard. Here is Kristi Noem reporting on apparently what they are trying to make sound like a major anti-terrorism coup by arresting the former girlfriend of the founder of Antifa. What do they call it? Antifa. Okay.
They have been so bold in making sure we're bringing those individuals to justice. One of the individuals we arrested recently in Portland was the girlfriend of one of the founders of Antifa, and that we are hoping that as we go after her, interview her, and prosecute her, we will get more and more information about the network and how we can root them out.
Lady's like 120 years old now.
Existence of American society. They have been so bold.
Okay, do we have Jack Posobiec? Do we have that clip from Posobiec talking about Weimar? At that same meeting, and this incidentally was a huge meeting assembled by Donald Trump of people who are reporting on Antifa. I don't know if this happened before or after Kristi Noem claimed to have captured the former girlfriend of one of the founders of Antifa, which is incidentally like saying we found one of the founders to the Red Sox fans. And But here is Jack Posobiec with a different idea of who, of, or maybe just a clue as to how old one of these founders are.
Mr. President, thank you so much for having us here today and holding this this roundtable. Antifa is real. Antifa has been around in various iterations for almost 100 years in some instances, going back to the Weimar Republic in Germany. Mr. President.
Oh, interesting. Say more.
Let's get into the substance of that. But so basically you have a situation where there is someone who is very old and hoping that his girlfriend does not spill the beans.
It was like an Anna Nicole Smith situation.
I mean, maybe when she said former.
I'm 135 years old, and if that girlfriend of mine speaks, I've told them all, never say my name.
I was going to say, maybe by former girlfriend of the founder of Antifa, she means like they were still together. She just. They're former because she's just not alive anymore. They have rested a corpse. That's what they mean. Yeah.
I think both of your theories are incorrect. I think the founder of Antifa and his girlfriend are vampires. And I think that what he's trying to like lay out
Sookie.
Is that
they've arrested Sookie.
They've been able to capture the queen of the damned, obviously.
This is now let's also talk about like the idea that like Antifa, as they say, it was goes back to Weimar Germany.
Hmm. What was their role?
I'm not a German historian, but what was it that was happening around Weimar Germany that would cause people to form Antifa? Was it the FA started to show up? It is sort of amazing that they're able to, like, get away with
that flag
not burning. Actually articulating what Antifa is. Maybe it was a mistake to call the
hey, Jack, don't bring up the Weimar thing next time, okay?
It's taking us down probably a little bit deeper than we want to go.
Such a teacher's pet, my God.
Wait till he finds out that Antifa opposed like the National Socialist, and he's going to get like, whoa, maybe we should look into this Antifa thing.
Weren't they the Weimar? That was the jihadis, right?
Radical Islam was doing something.
What was the? It is. I don't really know how to respond to any of this stuff. It's crazy. Except for let's just finish out the triptych here, I guess. This is the free speech part. Okay, yeah. Here is Trump explaining how they got rid of free speech. They didn't want to, but they had to.
We're stopping anti-fascism and we're
really
taking away free speech.
Clip. We are stopping the anti-fascists from taking away free speech by taking away free speech. And we didn't want to, but apparently the Supreme Court said we should.
A flag burning mob, and we've made it a 1-year penalty for inciting riots. We took the freedom of speech away because that's been through the courts, and the courts said you have freedom of speech. But what has happened is when they burn a flag, it agitates and irritates crowds. I've never seen anything like it on both sides, and you end up with riots. So we're going on that basis. We're looking at it from not from the freedom of speech, which I always felt strongly about, but never passed the courts.
Never, the freedom of speech never passed the courts.
We're taking away the freedom of speech, he said. He said, we're taking away the freedom of speech. That's Trump verbatim. And the free speech warriors on the right, everyone from Matt Taibbi to, the most MAGA Trump-ian guy you could think of are quiet on this. Very weird.
Well, we forced them to.
Yes. I mean, it was everybody had to accept the fact that COVID was real. So now we get,
so look at what you made me do.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Just to give you an update, the Supreme Court, I think, hasn't ruled on flag burning in like 30 years, is it maybe? And you're allowed to do that.
You never see what people do.
In fact, that guy, Nick Sortor, the right wing provocateur who caused this whole thing by going to I think he went to Portland, right? And he saw someone burning a flag, and the person was burning their own flag. He went over and took it from them, and then there was some altercation, and he got arrested. And this kicked off this whole thing with the Trump administration now looking further into, you know, Portland Antifa's ties with maybe even the Portland PD themselves. He brought that flag that he stole, stolen property. He brought that flag to show to Trump, and Trump is saying to him, we'll look into prosecuting that guy. You can buy a flag and burn it. And someone can take it from you, and they are the one committing the crime, because stealing in this country is illegal, whether it's a burning flag or not.
And so you're just writing off how irritated it gets people?
It's annoying.
Chafing. There's chafing, eczema, and all sorts of skin, like rashes. It gives you a rash.
Hives.
Lots of irritation.
I feel like you should be allowed to burn them because most of them are made in China. Like, what if I'm not burning it because I'm like against America?
What if
I'm burning it because I'm burning this American flag because I'm against Chinese manufacturing?
That's a defense.
Yeah. Well, checkmate, okay. Checkmate, Republicans.
Fair. You won. That's it.
Trump just stares at you like a shark. For He's like got 10 minutes.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm increasingly like the protest stuff is going to be more and more important, it seems to me. And I have to say, I don't know if we have that video. Do we have that video of Christy Gnome on the roof looking down?
I didn't bring it over.
The like one Batman? Where she's looking down and we hear the Benny Hill in the background just slightly.
Yes.
We'll play this later because I have a new, like, I've actually come around on protests. Like wearing costumes to protests. I used to be anti that, but now I'm like, I think like these anti-ICE protests, the best way to confront them is to be dressed up as an animal or something like that, or like a like any type of
conveying the message that it's ludicrous is
so
really
ludicrous.
Important.
Right. We'll get there, but before we get there, before we get to that, this is really important stuff because as a public service. A lot of people live their lives with what is known as TDS. That is Trump derangement syndrome. It has a lot of implications in terms of feeling good about yourself, feeling good with the world, your mood, and really even your pores. To be able to get rid of Trump derangement syndrome, the health and beauty benefits cannot be overstated. And how do we know that? Well, here we have a Seattle-based journalist, Brandi Cruz, talking about her awakening.
I'm going to tell it to you anyway, because it's relevant to what we're talking about. I'm living proof that you can recover from TDS. I had strong Trump derangement syndrome for probably 8 years. This is one of the reasons I recovered from it. And by the way, it's much better to not have TDS. I'm happier, I'm healthier, more successful. I even think I got a little more attractive after I got rid of my Trump derangement syndrome. Yes.
Very attractive.
She's playing him like a fiddle. She's Very playing him like a fiddle.
You are hired.
Yeah. My Trump derangement syndrome. Yes.
That's one word. Would.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up.
It occurs to me, just to your other point about the protesting with Christy Gnome or Kirsty Gnome, I always forget what order those go in her name. But I will say, you might, as part of that meta, just not want to dress up like a puppy or a dog if she's going to be at any of these particular rallies. Yeah, like, you know, she has a hair trigger for that kind of thing. So, you know, other animals, other non-canids.
But, I mean, do we have a before and after picture of the Seattle journalist?
No.
Because...
bad producing, bro.
What were you... Brian's too busy watching like a Jim Brewer
chemtrail video. Chemtrail video.
Now, I'd say, yes, you're very, very, looking very hot.
I mean, she may have lost some weight. She's so good.
You went from like a 4 to a 6, I would say.
Yeah.
Or like a 5 to a 7.
YouTube feels still struggling a little bit, though.
I mean,
a Mar-a-Lago 6. Yeah. Which is like, not an age
like,
joke.
First off, now that she's like a what kind of journalism is she doing now? Is she like
independent?
She's a female Andy. No, she's like, look at all this crazy stuff going on in Portland. That's the only thing that does numbers for her.
So she's now a journalist who is going to the anti-Antifa meeting and telling Donald Trump that she looks hotter now because she likes Donald Trump. This is like, I mean, this is like, I don't know, like this seems like an indication of like mounting psychological problems. Like where you literally are going and saying that, like, I genuinely believe I am hotter now that I am a fan of yours.
Sounds normal to me.
I mean, that makes sense.
I was that totally makes sense. Didn't like me.
It's true. I mean,
I think a lot of people get dumber as they get older.
This is just shocking. Like, I mean, what is she willing not to do as a journalist there on the ground? I mean, research? Honestly, if look. It helps. All right, let's talk about this. Benny Johnson, journalist, has been on tour with Kristi Noem. It's just a way like where he gets to like cover, be embedded around these uniformed men who are rounding up brown people. And he gets to follow Kristi Noem and ask her questions like, how are you feeling in this instance? And they went up onto the roof.
Also, a good excuse for his a good excuse for him to tell his wife why he's not home.
Well, exactly. I mean, listen.
Going to be in a bunch of different hotels.
It's going to be a lot of hotels. And listen, I'm going to be on call, so like I probably won't be able to answer the phone at certain times. I wouldn't worry about that at all. And don't get alarmed if I can't answer the phone at any given time. We've all been there. I'm sure. I mean, come on. And here he is on the roof of a building, and this is in Portland, right? Is that right?
Yes.
To survey, you understand, Portland is under siege. Mm. And there are hardened Antifa soldiers, paramilitary, who are around. And they're on this building to get a bird's eye view because it's not safe to be on the ground.
It's like the green zone in Iraq.
Yes, exactly, exactly. And so they've got up into like what is known in military parlay as a bird's nest. And this gives them a line of sight to all of the potential threat. They're doing a threat assessment on the roof. And let's get to this. You'll see they're pointing at stuff.
People drive down the interstate like they don't even know a war's going on.
You see down here, this is... Okay, now pause it. Freeze it. Don't take it down. What's going on here is the ice guy is saying to Kristi Noem, that's the ground. Right there, that's the ground.
You'll notice we're up.
Okay, that's and right down. Over there, you'll see to the left, those are cars, and they're driving on a road. And then right here, just below us, is ground, and they're pointing. There's going to be two what we call kinetic centers of unrest that they're going to be pointing to. One is to the left of this building of your eye line, and then one's going to be to the right, and you'll follow this. All right, go ahead. Pointing down there.
She's looking. She's looking.
Okay. Oh, wow. Oh, there it is. Look at oh, freeze that. Freeze that. Freeze that. Mm. Okay, folks, this is what they're dealing with. There's almost 20 people aligned there. Half of them have video cameras that they're set up to record it. And you will notice.
14 people.
This is brilliant. This is brilliant. The guy in the chicken suit. If you ever saw the movie Silver Streak, you would know that one of the strategies when you're trying to not be seen is to be so, like, obvious. Like, oh, so they don't pay attention to the man in the chicken suit.
In plain sight.
And here's the greatest part. Somebody's playing the Benny Hill song from down there, and you can hear echoes of it. It is so fantastic. And Betty Johnson, they've got to make this seem like there is a real threat going on here. Now, if you widen out, you will see that, yes, in fact, there's probably 22 people there.
Yeah.
And they are...
Okay to sell.
Yeah. They're on the side of the road.
Battalion. Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
Yep, the chicken suit guy's been there for 4 hours.
We've been surveilling the chicken suit guy. And
he hasn't laid one egg, man.
The eagle.
Now, let's point to some more. There's more protesters. Hold on. We have another line of sight to another cadre of protesters. You will notice that they are three clicks. Okay, if you could zoom in at 2 p.m., they're about three clicks away. And let's get eyes on them right now. Go.
The eagle has landed. Okay. That's what we say when the guy with the chicken costume gets there.
Okay, zoom in on that. Okay, you can see. All right. Okay. I don't see anybody. No, wait, pause it. Pause it. Hold on for 1 second. If you could go back to that, I think you're going to see there's someone there. She seems to be in some type of princess costume. She like vibrant colors.
Maybe she's an Episcopalian priestess.
There's something going on there.
I thought that was Grimace. And
I think there's somebody else out there who appears to be in a hoodie. You could see that, and there's multiple people with what are known as iPhones us on the
Brian,
roof.
Did they ever prepare you to deal with something like this when you were
I would be so overwhelmed in this situation, surrounded on two fronts.
Yeah.
I call that a beachhead.
This is like Black Hawk Down, right? Like, this is what happened. Down.
What
They're
is going
surrounded
on in
both
our city?
Sides. Get us out of here. We're on the roof.
We're the evac.
Look at me. Now, Betty Johnson's up there following around Kristi Noem, like desperate for some action. And so he's like, we better interview the head of the DHS. Go ahead.
You can hear Benny Hill now.
Yeah.
Secretary, do you have a message to the protesters, especially the man in the chicken outfit?
Man in the chicken outfit? I just see him now. Goodness sakes.
Wait up.
Pause it for a second.
Hey, how'd you miss
what
that?
What was she looking at?
Wow. Wow. Okay.
Is she in charge of border security? All dressed in yellow. What was she looking at?
I hope she can't drive.
Oh, you know what she's really thinking, though? Like, Benny, why'd you have to bring up the fucking chicken costume?
Exactly. Yeah. Oh, I didn't notice that the bulk of the protesters are dressed as Disney characters. This is why I think it is honestly, like, in general, in past protests, I've been like, don't wear the wacky hat. You know, like, I'm like a clean for Gene type of you know, protester. Like, go look as completely normie as possible. But protesting ICE as like a, you know, as a goofball makes them look like the jokes that they are. it completely lays bare their whole premise that these are, you know, hardened fighters that we're attacking on the ground. But instead, no, it's somebody who's like dressed as like, you know, Toucan Sam.
They're Mason the Frog.
Yeah, the frog or something.
Oh, speaking of the frog, have you seen this clip? I just put it in the chat. Pull it up. It's a recent one of that frog, the guy in the frog costume. And the ICE agents are backing away from the frog.
Oh, we played that a couple days ago.
Oh, yeah.
The voodoo magic frog?
Yeah, the voodoo magic frog. Oh, and man. Then they came and sprayed his ventilator with pepper spray. Yeah. They were so intimidated by him.
They were spraying his ass.
Let's listen to what she has to say about the guy in the chicken suit, because she's not messing around. And then watch how they have to backfill at the end of this video to make it seem like this is... I know it looked like nothing today, but go ahead.
Secretary, do you have a message to the protesters, especially the man in the chicken outfit?
Man in the chicken outfit? I just see him now. Goodness sakes. We could do better. Our goal is that people would peacefully protest, but that we would still be allowed to enforce the law in this country. So... Too
bad they're uneducated and ill-informed.
Good. It's good to see. We'll see what we can do to
get you back. This is absolutely nothing as to what it is at night, though.
We got to get that on the video. This doesn't even, it's almost three times as bad at night.
We just don't get that on camera.
There's guys wearing chicken outfits. There's one guy wearing a cat outfit. There's somebody dressed as a puppy. It's terrifying.
They're
wearing Halloween costumes. Like
we had a cow the other day. We had a cow with actual horns. They like wearing like a horn costume. Like somebody could have gotten impaled by that.
That's a bull, but yeah.
She's literally up there going, they could do better. No, there are cows that have horns. I'm sorry. She's literally up
there. That's the sort of chaos they're talking about. The debate that happens down there about cows and horns.
She's so disappointed. She literally says they could do better. Yeah, I mean, sorry. Sorry they're not providing you any predicate for the armed soldiers that you are surrounded by. Like, this is so... freaking ridiculous. Like, somebody better sit Betty Johnson down and say, like, dude, you don't know how we're spending. They literally are spending millions of dollars on propaganda. Yeah. There is not a single raid that you will see where you don't see at least one or two people with a handheld Steadicam and a video camera recording it. And then they're putting out all these videos. And for Betty Johnson to go around and release this video, which shows that there is absolutely no threat to anyone, that she is like it's just amazing.
The title was what? Christy Gnome stares down protesters.
Something like
or something.
Ridiculous. Like, yeah. It's so embarrassing.
This is how MS-13 members are identifying each other now. They're dressing up like chickens. It's all that part of that cartel lingo that is like for us civilians just arcane, but for someone like Christy Gnome, she sees someone dressed like a chicken, she sees someone dressed like a frog, she sees someone dressed like a cow, and she's like MS-13, Trinder Ragua,
El Pollos Locos.
Yeah, it's all there. It's all there. But you know, that's what it means to keep America safe at night.
This is like with the Bloods and the Crips, where they would wear the different color bandanas, and now you have Trinder Ragua all in chicken outfits.
The hens are the mules, and the roosters are the killers.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
This is the sophisticated like language of the streets that we know. Like I said, as squares, we're not privy to, but Christy Gnome and DHS and Benny Johnson, they're fluent in it.
It's kind of South Dakota street smarts you get.
Yes, exactly. Pier.
Honestly, like
pier.
Protesting with like bunny rabbit ears or mouse ears, and like going dressing up as like putting on these costumes, I think at this point is like so effective in undercutting the argument that these military interventions are necessary. I think it really, I am so sold on this. Do we have that video of that guy? What's that guy's name? The guy who sang the song?
Oh, yeah, that's in there.
This guy, he just goes out, and apparently he's done a bunch of stuff to irritate MAGA protesters in the past. And he is now going out and...
He went to that staging site in Broadville, Illinois, the ICE staging site outside of Chicago.
And what number is it? Do we have it? Or okay. And this guy is so annoying and so both annoying and benign. I love it. This is the kind of stuff like this is where this stuff works when you are trying to show the ridiculousness, the cosplay, the abuse. This is this guy. I don't even think he's from Illinois. I think he went up. So he's an outside agitator. He's an outside agitator dressed in a.
So is the Texas National Guard, I'd say.
Yeah.
No.
Is he in a dinosaur costume?
Yeah, he's in a dino costume.
Yeah, he's in a dinosaur costume, but he also sings. So listen to this.
Hell yeah. All around me are ICE agents. Hate all races except white faces. Early to catch brown people. No expression.
He's doing the lockjaw tip from One Battle After Another with his chin there. The guy up there.
The cop.
The cop is
the ICE guy. Yeah, he's really it's so fantastic.
The one in the back is laughing.
No expression, just regression. The tear gas going up their asses. No expression. No expression. I find it kind of funny. I find it kind of sad that ICE makes more money than all our veterans.
The video, I like it how like the ICE guys are videotaping him. We know who you are, man. Like he's it's not like he's trying to hide. He's got a microphone and a dinosaur costume.
And he edits.
He's not wearing a mask. Like ICE agent.
The dinosaur.
That is.
That's Robbie Rhodes streamer.
I feel like we've actually played something from him before.
He's been doing this.
I think this is incredibly effective because it just lays so much of the cosplaying that's happening with a bunch of, they're reducing the training time, incidentally. Like most of the guys that we have seen on these ICE videos, they got whatever training they got, which I don't think is.
All hold their weapons incorrectly. Every one of them.
They have now reduced the training. They are just shuttling people through and putting them in all sorts of military gear and just letting them loose on, elderly people, kids, moms, dads. The only way ultimately, I think, is to mock them to death on some level, because we're not going to have the weapons that they have. I find this just incredibly effective.
There's a sort of movement that undid Milosevic called Otpor was in Serbia did a lot of things like this. They put a barrel in the middle of the street with Milosevic's face on it and a bat right next to it, and just let people do what they wanted to do, and like those sorts of like specifically like trying to make it light out of like frankly authoritarian regime.
Well, I mean, I think the reason it's so effective is because so much around fascism and authoritarianism is like the theater, like the you know, the specter of power, like the theater surrounding these ICE raids. And when you undercut it with this kind of humor, it, you know, it reduces its effectiveness at making people afraid, even if, you know, ultimately very scary things are happening. So much of that is like the point. So much of the point is to make people feel afraid, to make them feel as though like more is ultimately happening or going to happen to them in the future, to keep them from mobilizing. And, you know, once you reduce that amount of fear, that it's very effective at keeping fascists from being able to project the amount of strength that they want to. And Trump is a good example of that, because he hates being made to seem like a fool.
And I think that, you know, one of the things that they've been doing, they've gotten out in front of their skis. I think they thought that the assassination of Charlie Kirk would give them more of a predicate than it ultimately did.
Yeah.
And they desperately need a predicate. And so you've got, Goebbels going out there, Stephen Miller, trying to say, like, you know, tell people, like, you know, Portland's on fire, 100, nights in a row of people who are threatening ICE agents and whatnot. And the idea is they want the ICE agents to create the predicate that they claim is there. And when people are showing up in costumes or singing, you know, songs that are like mocking them, and like, you know, the predicate just is not there. And so you've got like these, like, why are we deploying military on the streets to fight cartoon characters?
That's not so true. And that's a classic tactic in escalating protests that have been used by police for decades now. Like, they show up in riot gear so that the image that people see on the television is like a riot, right? So like, if we send police in riot gears, everyone is going to feel like it's more dangerous than it is. It creates that like specter of danger that gets people all hopped up, and then it just escalates. Like, and but sending people in riot gear is like meant to give the image of something more dangerous going on than it is. Any protest that police in riot gear show up to looks like a riot by nature of the police in riot gear being there.
Yeah.
I was going to say, like, in similar vein, it's why it's important when like someone of like a priest or something goes down there. Like, there's that clip of a pastor protesting in Chicago, and they're shooting rubber bullets or something, and one of the ICE agents literally shoots one of the pastor who's out there in the forehead, and he falls to the floor. And like, you know,
let's play this footage. I think we have it now. This is from September 19th, same city as where you have the dinosaur that was singing. And you have people outside the Broadview facility, and three, I don't know what you would call them, snipers with their pepper pellet guns on the roof of the facility. There are, I don't know, again, maybe 10 protesters there, and they are standing out in front of the gate. There's like three or four of them. There's no indication that anybody's trying to clear them in any way. And you see a priest there, or I should say a Presbyterian minister. His name is David Black. He is okay. Yeah, here we go.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. Here we go. Watch this. Oh, yeah. Oh, there's a different angle that I've seen. Okay, let's see the other angle. Where you can see, this is it. Here's the priest. He's out in front, looking up, calling to these paramilitary guys, and they're there with their, you know, paintball guns that are firing pepper pellets that will create a massive welt on you. And watch.
And you can see they shoot two before. There's one. There's another one.
They were aiming for his head.
They were aiming right for his head.
Definitely. Unclear, you know, I mean, I guess, like, I they're just shooting, literally shooting fish in a barrel.
What's the threat right there? I don't even understand what they're...
Exactly. Like, what are the rules of engagement that they have? If you see somebody who looks like they're being too pleading with you from, 30 feet below you, you should fire for the head.
You got to imagine they have like a scorecard internal to ICE. Like when they go on these little missions, they they go like, hey, you hit a priest in the head, 50 points. You hit like a pregnant lady, 20 points. Like, yeah, they're just doing the kind of like bingo game out there.
It's a way to take the pressure off of the quota they have for rounding up brown people.
You know, and I also think, you know, we have to concede that like a lot of the illusion around like ICE and around like ethno-nationalism, not just in America, but, you know, in Israel and abroad, is that it's meant to protect white people, or it's meant to protect like, you know, white Christians, like broadly speaking. And I think we can all understand that that's just like a part of the selling of it to people who don't directly benefit from like the capitalist system that it's ultimately protecting. And so like when ICE does things like this, just like when the police push down old white people and their head cracks on the skull, like on television, it does, I think, disabuse people of this mythology that like what Trump is trying to do is establish some sort of white Christian nation, because they see like that his regime is openly antagonistic to those values, not just rhetorically, but like, yeah, like they just shot a priest in the head. This is the first shots fired in the war on Christmas this year came from Republicans, and they shot a it was ICE shooting a police officer, right? I mean, a priest right in the head.
He was actually saying Merry Christmas.
They're gonna have Santa at SeaCot this year. They're gonna have like not just the Grinch. They're gonna put Santa in one of the El Salvadorian concentration camps, and no one is gonna be able to enjoy a Merry Christmas. But that's always been like the ultimate goal of the Republican Party.
It is the thing too. I would have to say that what we're seeing now with all this with the violence, and they're desperately trying to come up with a reason to get the military into Portland or into Chicago. The court case that had enjoined the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals temporarily stayed Judge Immergut's order. Judge Immergut is the Reagan-appointed or Trump-appointed lawyer. I mean, a judge, I think. She had blocked. She had done two things. She had blocked the federalization of the Oregon National Guard, not just the Oregon one, but California to come to Oregon, and I think Texas to come to Oregon. And then she also prohibited the deployment of federalized troops into Portland. The Ninth Circuit has temporarily stayed the order blocking the federalization of the Oregon National Guard, but the deployment of those troops in Portland, and she's a Trump nominee, has still remains in effect. So, in other words, the ability of the president to federalize the National Guard, the bar is lower than the ability of the president to then deploy these troops into a city. And so that's where we're at this point. But they're desperate to get this going, because if they don't, you know, like this slows the momentum. They are losing the sort of like the sense of alarm that was going on in the country in the wake of Charlie Kirk's assassination. They did not get the culprit that they wanted out of the Charlie Kirk assassination.
They forgot that our society is completely comfortable with violence.
I mean, it cuts both ways, right? Like, oh, 1.5 million people died in COVID? That was a fake. Let's move on.
Also, every day that passed, there's another, like, far-right person who shoots somewhere up. So, like, every day that gets past the Charlie Kirk shooting where they have a leftist in custody is another day where, like, a neo-Nazi shoots up a school or, like, an incel shoots up, like, a yoga center or something like that. A black church gets bombed. So, like, they really have to, like, head that off at the start.
Yeah, they can't talk about it. Because there is no language that they have that has a problem with that level of violence. And so, like, unless it's like you're doing a disservice, you'd be smirching Charlie Kirk. Incidentally, 300 investigations opened by the Pentagon of military personnel who have been disrespectful to Charlie Kirk. 300 on social media. 300 investigations.
Does that count ex-military personnel?
What's that?
Does that count ex-military personnel?
I mean...
Oh, wow.
And without that, they just don't have the sort of the juice that they need to justify this stuff. And the other problem they have is that they want to go into blue cities, and these cities tend to be media centers. And so it's much harder for them to go into these bigger cities because there's news there. There are people, like, there's like three channels that go out and collect video. And if there was some type of like mass violence that made it difficult for people to operate in these cities, these news channels would carry it. So we're in a very strange area right now,
which is why I think your point that to make these guys look as foolish as possible, so it completely downplays whatever they're trying to manufacture, is the perfect sort of strategy.
Yeah, I think so. More Benny Hill. I mean, folks should really. I've got a Spotify list now. Of songs that I have, specifically my ICE playlist, just in the event. The Star Wars Imperial Soldier, what is that?
Imperial Death March.
Yeah, the Death March one, the Benny Hill, the knockoff Benny Hill, just in case you want to, monetize the video.
Sam, if you were in Portland, what would you dress up as to go down to the protests?
Well, I have been, I've actually have some experience dressing up as characters. I once had a gig as a Easter Bunny at the mall. I once was Sam the Olympic Eagle. It was a Buick dealership.
Okay.
Like, this was years ago when they...
Buick.
And I once went out, my friend's mom owned a croissant shop in Worcester. It was like an au bas pain type of thing, but before there was au bas pain. And, Worcester's not going to support that. But I had a sandwich board and a beret. I think that's always a good one.
Oh, you got to go down to protest like that.
Maybe like a mime.
Yeah, like a mime would be good.
Yeah.
Or, but I also think, like, well, maybe dress up as a cowboy. Like somebody suggested, I think, like the cowboy in Toy Story.
Woody.
Yeah. Or Gumby. You could go out as Gumby. Or a Teletubby. That might be fun.
They're just pounding you with a baton.
Yeah. Teletubby. Or one of the Paw Patrol guys.
Yeah, go out as Bluey. So, like, the children of the ICE agents have to, like, explain why, like, to their young children, why they were, like, cracking Bluey's skull.
Daddy, why were you hitting Bluey?
Dora the Explorer.
That was not Bluey. That was a very dangerous criminal.
It was a Trojan Bluey, son.
Oh, yeah. He'd go out as village people.
Oh, minions.
Yeah. That would conflict Trump. He'd be like, stop hurting the village people.
Wait a second.
Leave him alone.
Wait a second.
If you lay one finger.
You ask Ronald McDonald. Trump would never allow that.
The best leftist, the Swedish chef. Oh, that's a good one too.
Yeah.
A Muppet. Yeah. This episode of Bluey is called Skullcrack. It's an anti-pop blockhead. All right. Let me read a couple more IMs and then we'll wrap things up. Unless you guys got something that, we really gotta, you got to hand it to Stephen Miller. No, really, he can't reach it, says Candia tried. Henry, got to clip the singer belting out MAGA World. Yeah, I think so. Slippery Fish, I've been a USDA employee and contractor for the past 15 years. One important thing to note on Trump's proposed bailout of soybean producers, the agency who be doing that work, the Farm Service Agency, is currently furloughed. All USDA funds to farmers are currently on hold, causing absolute chaos with farmers trying to implement farm bill funded programs. It is a crap show right now. Wayward leftists. Republicans have had years to actually put together a budget that continue to kick the can down the road with continuing resolutions. Why is that, Mike Johnson? El Conniption, if you protest as the Burger King, you're definitely getting clapped. Small D, Democrats. Liberals are too grossed out by the types of power creation that conservatives are constantly working on to build anything. They find power gauche. Truck nuts. Jordan Peterson also started an online academy as well. It's promoting it as an alternative to college. It looks terrible.
Yeah, how's he doing?
Peterson is not well, apparently.
Yeah, no. He's like
no,
under
the clean
the
your room guy has mold problems, apparently.
He's been living with mold for a decade? It's causing neurological problems?
Yeah, I don't know if we've quite got to the bottom of it, but that's the story so far.
I thought he always had one of those diseases that used to affect like ladies back during like the Jane Austen times, like where they say you have like dropsy or like, you know, he spent too much time in an urban sense, vapors or
hysteria,
yeah, like miasma, like yeah, well, he definitely has hysteria.
Miasma is moving through. I got the patient coach.
I know he also has another disease called addicted to benzos or something.
He supposedly recovered from that. Benzos are tough to get off of. They're very difficult. I mean, I don't know this firsthand, but I know it the secondhand. Yeah. I thought he got through that with like the all meat diet. And now.
Yeah, that'll do it.
Maybe that's the problem.
Nothing goes through you with an all meat diet. That's the problem.
Yeah. Well, but because then he almost got killed by the apple cider, which he was allergic to, and almost.
Oh, right, the apple cider. Oh, that was.
This is what it means to be a man, to just constantly be
exactly
upset on all sides by antagonism. Like he's the last real alpha.
Jody from Chicago. I just saw pictures of the Texas National Guard getting out of a truck in Chicago. I thought Pete Hegseth said no beardos or fatties. Also, my cousin is part-time in the Illinois National Guard, and he said he'd be deployed in Illinois shortly. So just we know we got one good lefty in there. I'd be curious what the National Guard who have to get like deployed in the city, like what are they saying?
Well, I bet Texas might be a little more sympathetic.
Well, that's the thing, is like you don't want to send your own National Guard into the city. That's not going to help. Bullprog, someone at that press conference yesterday literally said the homeless industrial complex is running cover for Antifa. Yeah. Amazing.
Yeah, it's definitely not the military industrial complex, which comes out in the different budgets of all these repressive forces, whether it's ICE or the cops or the feds.
One guy, one time, Sam, out of morbid curiosity, I went looking for your Netroots interview with Van Jones. I couldn't find it, but I did find a 2012 Netroots interview with Tim Pool. I can tell from your tone that you were not impressed with him. I don't remember that, the Tim Pool one, but I did not interview Van Jones at Netroots. I'm quite convinced it was like in, I want to say it was in the fall, maybe in the winter. And it was after Netroots. Maybe it was in December. It was, would have been just an audio interview. So we'd have to go. It'd be very difficult. I mean, theoretically, we should be able to find it, I guess. I gotta look for that. All right, three more of these. Jay from Tulsa. If I've said it once, I've said it a thousand times. However much you hate Ryan Walters, you don't hate him enough. Being too Christo-fascist for blood red Oklahoma should tell you what you need to know. Most egregiously using the murder of Nex Benedict, a student nominally under his care, to lash out at the woke left.
Yeah.
Drummond is likely to win the primary and thus the governor's chair. And while I don't like him, he's better than the love child of Stephen Miller and Joel Osteen. All right, two more. Saturn Girl. I said the very same thing Brandon just said several weeks ago, and you said it was very unlikely to see the far right break with Trump at all. But that's what we're seeing with Tucker and Candace. They smell blood in the water, and they see the outlines of a post-Trump right-wing movement, and that movement must appeal to class. The primary contradiction on the right now has to do with class. Trump has thrown in his lot with the billionaire imperialist tech bros with the right-wing Christian fascist yeoman farmer types. It's becoming more decentralized. Ultimately, they just want a little local fascist fiefdoms controlled by their own militias. Hyper-individualism is a more fundamental facet of American culture than patriotism.
Well, two media figures is one thing. I just say, like, I haven't seen it reflect in the polling very well, but I did see a clip of, what was the Anthony, is it Scaramucci?
Yeah.
He was saying Trump told him, my base is fiscally liberal, socially conservative. that's what my people are. Don't get it twisted, which I think says a lot.
I will say this. I think that, and Brandon, then I want to hear what you say, but I will, like, I do think two things that you may be right about. There are right wingers who are envisioning a post Trump world. And that's smart because Trump could be a lame duck after 2026. In some fashion, you know, you maybe still be doing the, also the guy, you know, there could be reason to believe that he is on shakier grounds in ways that we don't know. The Epstein stuff, but whatever follows Trump is going to be very similar to Trump, without the charisma. And so, like, I don't know that breaking from Trump in this instance means anything meaningful for right-wing talkers. Brandon, do you feel, how do you feel about this?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it remains to be seen, especially post Epstein and post all, once Trump is actually out of office, like what this break actually means. But I think more than anything, it's not a break so much as they're going to be pulling the right further to the right. Like the right wing in this country is primed to become even more Christo-fascist, even more misogynist, and even more like racist. And that's the thing I want to latch on to. Like, they're definitely, I think the schism we're seeing is definitely breaking down along class lines. But the kinds of arguments I'm seeing coming out of like Candace Owens and like Tucker Carlson are not like really explicitly appealing to class. They're appealing to Christo-nationalism, like the idea that, like, you know, just like an anti-Zionist Christo-nationalism, one that's just like not rooted in the same kind of Schofield Bible interpretation of like the rapture. They're appealing to a lot of people based on like the same kind of incel talking points, which is what gets them on some of the more like bro adjacent podcasts. And so I don't think the danger is that there's going to be some like meaningful long-term schism in the Republican Party. I think just like with the Tea Party, the Republican Party apparatus, the military industrial complex, is just going to do their best to incorporate the new crazier elements of the base into that same machine that will just give us, like, you know, Sam is saying, like another Republican president who's like worse than Trump, but still going to be serving the same paymasters likely.
Yeah.
Darth Moose, between JBP, Fetterman, and RFK Jr., we're getting too much evidence that brain damage leads to unhinged conservatism. John Brown Society, Sam, please inform Matt Lecht that he's being offered the position of lieutenant general to lead the resistance. We looked through previous producers of the Majority Report. He appears to have the best war-fighting spirit. We need him to channel his inner crazy horse in Sitting Bull. Thankfully, unlike Colonel Custer, we're pretty sure Secretary Hegseth is a far less competent adversary, especially after his 10 a.m. whiskey shots.
Is that job more than 3 hours a day?
I was going to say, it sounds like a lot of work.
Uh-oh.
Can I do it from like a...
I was gonna say...
I'm pretty sure he literally yawned as he was reading that.
What time do I have to show up?
I had no idea what you were doing.
Oh, sorry, I tried to... I can't.
It took me a minute too, but
sorry. That was a little juice. And the final IM of the day, revolutionary status quo. We have to view these latecomer Trump supporters with the same skepticism as Catholic converts. Like, out of all the options, you chose this. Matt, Brian, great job today. Matt, Brandon, also great job today. We'll put links to both your shows in the podcast and YouTube descriptions. Folks, see you tomorrow.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm going to get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught. Between the truth and the lie, fall. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. And my pilot light's shining bright. I get somewhere the choice is made. For the option where you don't get paid. For the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive. Between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking. But the meds are gonna kick. Hey.